go?
Yep.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is September 9th, and this is the second rendition of the Expanded Budget Committee for 2019. I'd like to thank you all for being here. We have a lot of work to do. We're going to hear from budget presentations from eight departments, and we're going to hear about 21 over-target requests tonight. I want to thank everyone for the preparation, Kevin. I see you've got some things, and I'll give you a second to talk about them and after I just finish one thing. Last time we got this nice document that shows the presentations each night, and one of the nice things about it, I take it back, it's the long one, it gives some approximate time for the presentations. Now, I realize we can't all always fit them into those exact times, but I think it's a goal that we ought to have. So one of the things you're doing while you're listening tonight is keep your eye on this, and if your question needs to be asked, ask it. But if it's already been asked and answered, let's go on. Kevin, you want to talk about, I'm sorry.
I feel like we can put it on the timer for those time frames, and it would let everybody know when the time is up.
Well, I'm game, but I don't know everybody else. Oh,
suggestion.
Okay. Well, if it's 10 o'clock before we get out of here, we'll do it next time. How's that? Want to thank Leslie and Bean Claiborne for bringing snacks tonight for us, and also Amanda Champion for handing out our chocolate fix for tonight.
I have more. Anyone needs any?
Kevin, you want to talk about what you brought us?
Thanks, Mike. Correction pages on a new higher legibility, lighter color. These several correction pages are all due to one tiny typo that I believe was my fault. I was helping the sheriff's office with their OTRs, and I misdirected the fringes on OTR number 93 to functional unit 3110 rather than 3113. That error resulted in the replacement of a summary page in the OTR summary in section 2 and three pages in section 4. But it's now accurate. So.
Does that mean less money or more money?
It's the same money. It's just going to the right place.
Gotcha.
That's all I have.
Jason or Rick, anything before we start?
I have nothing to add.
Our first department tonight is Weights and Measures. And Don Ellis is here. And Don, we're all ears.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I brought my inspector, my new inspector, who I just hired in July, Aaron Becker, over here in the blue.
Welcome, Aaron.
Good evening, everyone.
So I'm starting the training process all over again. So there was one OTR for my budget this year. The numbers from last year are staying pretty much the same. They're up just a touch from last year with a one-time OTR, and I asked for another one-time OTR to continue training of my new inspector. Major influences are, like you guys have already known for a couple of years now, I'm leaving early in 2020, and Aaron will be taking over for me. So in order to continue full-time training in the short amount of time I have left, the county administrator has approved my OTR for next year. That way we can keep everything going the way we have been for 6 months this year. Aaron's learning everything very quickly. I've already got him out from time to time working on his own, but there's still a lot of little nuances that he needs to learn. And so, like I said, the full-time equivalents for next year are going to be two, thanks to the OTR. I'm hoping to stick around for at least the first 3 or 4 months of next year. Get things keep going. And that's all I have. Nothing too exciting.
Let's start with questions. I saw Mike first, then Anna, then Ann.
This is really more of a question for Jason. I mean, I'm not one to really spend more money, but wouldn't it be wise? I mean, this job, I mean, he knows where all the buildings are. The new guy's not. Wouldn't it be wise to actually hire even another person and have him training up two people and making it a two-person department? I mean, that, we're losing a lot of institutional knowledge when you leave. And I wouldn't think that that's going to harm us one way or the other. And I mean, if Aaron is sick or something, we got nobody. Not that you're going to get sick. Good shot. But I mean, that just seems like
there is another half a position to be hired. So this is actually a department that's a 1.5 position, a director and a part-time inspector. What Skip is going to be doing is staying on as the director for the next few months into the year, and then Aaron will move up to be the director. Skip will stay on to assist with that transition. At that point, then they can go into hiring another part-time inspector.
Okay.
So that, I think, is the original goal. If the legislature at some point in time wants to consider a full two FTEs at that department, that it really wasn't part of the discussion, but I'm not going to say no to that, but it just wasn't anything that we discussed. It's really the transition and then having Aaron fill in full-time with Skip still on to be able to assist.
Let's see. We had Anna next.
Question. Thank you so much, by the way, for all of your work and sticking with us for so long. I know you've been wanting to retire for a while, so thanks for your patience.
No, not a problem.
I'm curious. There's a lot of things that we've added that are added to your plate over the last couple of years. For example, one of them being the products with microbeads. And I'm curious if you have found with the person and a half that you've had that all of the things that we've added to your plate or that have been added to your plate, you've been able to sufficiently evaluate to the caliber or the quality that you would prefer.
As far as the microbeads go, New York State passed a law that would supersede ours, and according to the local law, once New York State passed that, then I didn't have much of anything to do with it. They were going to deal with all that. So that's kind of off my plate now. I don't have to worry about that. Everything else we've been keeping up with. Aaron has not yet started the package checking part of the job, but he's still learning how to do the devices. Where Steve, who was my previous inspector, he had already started into the package checking, was going out and doing that while I was still doing devices.
And have you found that the people, the new people, are able to do it at the speed that you are able to do it at?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Package checking, I didn't get into much of it at all because I didn't have time to do it.
And having 1.5 people has allowed that.
Yeah.
Great,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yep. And Corman?
Thank you, Skip. The I know last year you talked about wanting another, changing the half-time position to a full-time position.
Yep.
For a couple of reasons. To my recollection, the two, and feel free to correct me, the two main reasons were for the enormous amount of training that your positions entail. So a lot of the time you're getting the training.
Right.
And then the other issue was you weren't able to keep up with some of your tasks that you were that you had. So I'm wondering if you can address those issues.
The reason why I wanted Steve to come on full time for this present year was there's a lot of devices that I only do like 1 or 2 days during the year, and if he's not here that time, during that time, he's not going to see it or learn how to do it from me. As a matter of fact, the next 2 days, Aaron and I are doing fuel oil trucks, and those are the only 2 days we'll test fuel oil trucks. So if he'd already worked his 20 hours at being part-time, then he wouldn't be able to be there to help out with it. So that was the reason why I was looking to have somebody on full-time to get him trained adequately. As far as the work, 1.5 would be able to get 98-99% of the work done. So
you're feeling sufficient 1.5?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The But like I say, right now, Aaron is actually full-time. So he's learning everything mm-hmm. in a rush.
And so you'll be staying on to help train the other half-time person also, or to continue
possibly,
training Aaron?
Possibly. Aaron's learning it quite well. So I think he can handle training the part-time person when he hires somebody.
Okay. So since we won't be possibly seeing you here, probably seeing you here next year, thank you, as Anna said, for your service.
Thank you.
Dave, then Martha.
Yeah, I'd just like to put in my bid to have it a two-person shop, basically a half person. It's not likely to stick around very long, as we've found out. So that's the way I feel about it. I think it's penny wise and pound foolish to do it there. It's a half-time job.
Martha?
Thanks. I hear you, Dave. Sometimes a half-time job fits some people who couldn't actually do a full-time. Mike's suggestion was interesting. Bring in the half-time person sooner rather than later, and then you're training two at once. No? Is that... You know, and there's a little bit of overlap, but would that make sense?
Yeah. Like you say, Aaron's learning this quite well. Aaron is a very detailed, thorough investigator, I guess you could say. When I tell him, you know, go read up in this manual, he wants to know every single detail. If there's a reference to another book, he wants to know what that reference means. He's very detail-oriented, so he's picking it up very quickly.
I guess then let me ask Jason, is there... That's great. I mean, that's fantastic. That's really wonderful news. I'm glad to hear it. But yet still the idea of training two at once, is that something that... What do you think about that?
I mean, they have the ability to do it. And, you know, come the new year, if they feel comfortable doing that, we can move forward with hiring that person sooner than later. I would really defer to Aaron and Skip on that as to what they think is the best choice in moving forward with that. They have the capability to do it, so it's not a money issue. It's just it's probably both a training and a capacity issue. You know, training people takes time and energy, and you know, obviously, if that's something they come say, listen, we want to move on this, we'll move with them on it and get people, you know, get the hiring process started. If not, then we'll go about it how they see fit. You know, leave that up to them.
If you'd like to speak, come to the microphone.
I understand what everybody here is saying. Once again, my name is Aaron Becker. I'm very pleased to meet all of you. I do see a one minor hurdle with this, and it's office space accommodations to have another person half-time being trained. So there'd be three people in one small office. I just wanted to bring that point up.
We can. True enough. I mean, if that was the case, we'd probably try to make some arrangements at the conference room and that public works facility. But, you know, if that was the case and both Aaron and Skip say, hey, this is what we want to do, then we'll make it work. It's a true enough point, but we'll find the space to make it work with you. There's a few other people in that building that we could tap into that might have some open space. Right, Rel?
I think Anna was next.
No, I was going to ask if Aaron could speak.
Yeah, Rich, was your hand up? Somebody else had their hand up.
I was just making sure you saw Aaron's hand.
Oh, okay.
Just so you know, also, Aaron has worked with us before. Aaron was a mechanic over in Highway, and Skip stole him from Jeff. So
that's two I stole from Highway.
Yeah, so not new to the organization. He's been with us for a while, so he's a good employee, and we're proud to have him, move up in the organization.
Jason, I wondered... With this succession as planned, do we have any civil service issues?
No, I don't think. I don't know if the part-time position is competitive or not. Is there a list, or no?
No, there is not a list,
and it probably wouldn't be for the part-time. So we would most likely be hiring provisionally, which isn't uncommon.
Yeah, the weights and measures inspectors test is usually about once every 2 years, because there's not a lot of inspectors scattered throughout the state. There's certain counties that'll have three or four inspectors and other counties that only have part-time directors. So it's a big variety of how this is covered in different counties.
So when you say hire provisionally, that means the provision is that at some point that person has to pass the test.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah, that's not an uncommon practice, but it's normal. And like you said, this is one of those situations where you don't. It's not a position that tests 2-3 times a year.
Yeah, the way things are going right now, I would dare say that Aaron would probably take the director's test before the inspector's test comes up.
Any other questions? Don, thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone. Have a good evening.
We're next up is our county attorney, Jonathan Wood. This is Section 4, page 32. There are no over-target requests.
Noticed my budget is really exactly the same as last year, and I have no over target requests, so there's probably not a lot to say that's different. All these expenditures in that first slide here are just the added by administration to reflect the changes of salary and et cetera, but they don't represent any change by the department. I did want to spend just a few minutes on major influences. I asked Kevin what I said last year, and he said books, and then I looked it up, or Aaron looked it up, and he was right. One of the major issues we've had over several years, and it's common to pretty much all law offices, is that books have become much more expensive. And as more and more things are done online, it becomes harder and harder to keep up on the books you need. But this year we were able to make a better arrangement with the publishing company, which basically involves us having more online and less books. And at least for the time being, I think throughout the next couple of years, we're probably okay. But it's going to be a continuing issue, as I think it is for all law firms. So that's really, you know, something which has been an issue for several years, I think, is probably less of an issue. The few things I was thinking that are influences, the amount of litigation has varied quite a bit. This year we've had an appeal which has taken a lot of time and expense. A lot of the expenses in litigation are actually come out of the reserve fund, the self-insurance fund. They don't come out of my budget, but most of the costs are incurred by my office. So it's really a separate budget. But the amount of litigation varies largely, and hopefully this coming year won't be as bad as this current year. I think I've talked about it before, that each year we end up doing what I listed here is special projects, but different things which change by the year. So this year, for example, we spent a lot of time on the DOT relocation project and other airport-related things because it was a major year for the airport. I think this coming year, probably the biggest project, which is going to take a lot of our time, is the county office buildings issue and what to do about that. And then I think we discussed it last year, but as you probably know, they've raised the age to 16, started this past year, to 17 will be this October. So far, its impact on the office has been relatively minimal, but once 17-year-olds are added, it could be greater. I mean, it should be greater, but it's hard to tell. Like I think I mentioned last year, it's probably going to take a few years to really see what the effect of that is going to be. But it's a concern or influence. It's something we got to keep an eye on, how it affects our business. Because basically what it does is it takes cases that were previously in the DA's office, basically 16 and 17-year-olds, and put some of them, but not all of them, into the county attorney office. So long as the numbers remain relatively low, it's not an issue. I should go back. You know, one of the major influences on that is just age and demographics. Over the years, like the number of JD cases has gone down somewhat, and PIN's case is simply because of demographics. There are fewer people in that age category. But then you raise, widen the age category to 16 and 17, and that changes that dynamic. And so what's been kind of a thing which has been going down for years, that trend is going to end and start either going up or plateauing at best, I think. And the full-time equivalents, I expect to be the same. As you probably remember, a year or so ago, Susie retired and is now half-time, and Bill Troy is half-time. And so far it seems to be working well. But, you know, if the caseload, et cetera, increases, it's just something to keep an eye on. But I'm not expecting anything different this year. And that's pretty much all I have to say. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for John. Go ahead. Martha.
Jonathan, you've got on our section 4, page 32, it's your sort of the consolidated budget page. Mm-hmm. You've got professional services in 2019 went up a bunch to 30,000 and change. Is that like when you have to hire an outside attorney because there's a conflict with, a personnel matter or something like that?
It could be. So the reason why that was increased is basically when when Susie went to halftime, as well as Bill being halftime, we wanted to have some basically a buffer so that in the event we had litigation that we couldn't cover and I would need to hire somebody else, for example, we wouldn't have to come back each time and get authorization. There are other things that are paid out of that as well. For example, the county code is paid out of that. Certain expert fees are paid out of that. And it could vary quite a bit from year to year. But we wanted to have some buffer in that rather than have, like, another attorney. It would just make sense to have a professional services line, which would provide some buffer.
Okay. Thank you.
Anna?
Do we have any plan to move the code completely to electronic? Does it even exist? And if so, is it exorbitantly expensive and that's why we're not doing it?
No, the code is electronic.
Okay, so what were you referring to?
Go to general code, just look up general code on the internet, and then it breaks it down by state. And if you go to New York State and look up County of Tompkins.
I've done that, okay. Yeah.
And it's searchable by keyword, too. So
ask a question about what you were talking about earlier about keeping up with books. Which then ones were you referring to?
Well, all books have become more expensive. So, like, if you walk in my office now, you will see many pages of the New York Code, which is what they call McKinney's, but it's all the laws of New York State, the statutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it covers, I don't know, there are probably like 300 volumes of it or things like that. And every year, up until like last year, we've been updating it every year, which means you get new pocket parts, which to update you on most recent cases, as well as when they replace certain volumes periodically.
Right. So my question is, Are they transitioning all of those to be online?
So all of those are online.
We
the
just
thing
have...
is we are now stopping getting them in paper. It's just become too expensive. So those things which we've updated for years and years,
we
just can't
no longer
afford to keep that going. We expanded somewhat our what we get in our electronic, because all these things have always been online. It's a matter of what you're willing to pay for. So we've expanded somewhat what we get electronically, but we've just basically had to give up updating in physical form a lot of the books.
So last question, is getting the equivalent amount of information that we had in physical form an expense, or is that free?
It's not free. So it's less expensive than getting it in physical form.
You have to remember that a lot of the, shall I say, the more mature attorneys were trained on books. The ones coming up now are trained on their laptops, and so they're very much used to the electronic versions. John, I've got to bring this up. I always bring it up every year, and that's about the social services attorneys. Who supervises them now, and should they be supervised by the county attorney's office?
Always a tough question, and you ask it all the time. As you know, I mean, one issue we have with it is simply physical. Like, we have the county attorney's office over here and the social services office over there, and it's sort of difficult geographically to have one supervision. So, you know, in the social services department, they've actually had some recent changeover in attorneys, and they've actually had some recent changeover in what roles each attorney is playing. Which is a good question for Kit, because she could explain it better than me. But they've had some turnover as well as some change in what the functions of the various attorneys are. I mean, there's some advantage to having the people under the county attorney's office, because then you could kind of cover for one another. We do that somewhat anyway. It's maybe somewhat easier. People could have a little more diverse practice in that you can do more things. On the other hand, and one of the issues is always that a lot of their work is reimbursed by the state while none of our work is. So there's a trick to getting the formula right so that you're not getting less and hopefully getting more if you combine them. But there's a whole lot of issues in it. But physically, it's an issue right now because it's simply the physical location. But, you know, it's obviously a possibility. It's something some counties do that and others don't.
So since we're beginning to look at space issues with a possible new building, should we be thinking about whether there'd be any advantage to expanding that office to have room for social services attorneys?
Yeah, I mean, it makes some sense. I mean, you know, there are... there have been times, and I think different social service directors have had different views of it. Generally social service directors, because the attorneys for the social service work for this director of the social services department. They don't. Certain directors may not want to give up that power. As you know, the social service director before the current one was in the legal unit for many years before she became the director of social services. I think there are advantages and disadvantages, because on the one hand, it's good to be with the other people in social services, the caseworkers, et cetera. On the other hand, it's also good to be in a law office. And they really haven't had as far as I know, a real supervising attorney. Things have changed over the years. But it's certainly worth exploring, talking to the new commissioner, well, relatively, of social services and seeing what her views are and and whether that could be managed. But with new offices, it does kind of open that opportunity to talk about something that we haven't really talked about before or had the opportunity to do before we talked about it.
I go to Henry next, but I just wanted to make one comment to remember that all of these attorneys are deputy county attorneys, but Jonathan doesn't actually supervise directly the ones at social services. Henry.
So outside council fees are not included anywhere in your budget?
They are not. They are kept track of in largely in the self-insurance fund. Although we have sometimes we hire attorneys for things which aren't covered by that fund. For example, that fund covers litigation and personnel matters, but we've had some other things which don't fall into that category. For example, we have an attorney who helps planning. That's actually come out of our budget because we had the money for it. So help with property issues, for example. So it's a bit of a mix.
Okay, any other questions for John? John, thank you very much.
Thank
we appreciate
very
the
much.
Presentation. We go next to our county historian, Carol Kamen.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm not asking for anything over, but I would love to tell you what the Office of County Historian does. That's all right with you.
Go ahead.
This year, there have been 10 meetings of the municipal historians. Every community in the county has an appointed historian, and we get together and do all sorts of very exciting things, like talk about how to write citations. But we do have a good time doing all of that. The county historian oversees the celebration grants, which is an STPB program. We're having our meeting tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And we will have by the end of the year given out $40,000 in terms of small community grants under $3,000, many way under $3,000. But we've also nurtured a lot of county organizations that have gone on to become really important institutions in the county. This year I brought out with a colleague something called Achieving Beulah Land, which is the only county history in the state of how suffrage was achieved. I will send you the test online on Thursday, and I hope you all do well. The book has been cited a number of times in reports to the state about how the state is celebrating the upcoming anniversary of women voting, and it's an important subject. And the county historian's office, which is in the new history and culture building, is being worked on. And I will invite all of you to come visit me the end of October when I think it will all be put together. And so that's what the county historian has been doing. And I did want to say, when Weights and Measures was reporting, that the first item the county bought in 1817 was a set of true measures, so people could trust the measures that were being used. I thought that was sort of nice. The other piece of my budget, we don't have a budget, anything to show them? Oh, I don't know how to do that. You know that. Thank you very much. The other piece of my budget is allocated to the Tompkins County Historical Commission, which has turned into a very exciting enterprise with two main thrusts. The first is encouraging research and publishing material about the county to make the county history come alive. We have a first pamphlet coming out, authored by myself and Joe Mariani, so how could you not want to read that one? And that test will come out about a week after the book comes out. It's a long essay about how the county physically expanded, and then in the 20th century, how the functions of the county expanded. So to say it's an administrative history makes it sound really dull, but it's wonderfully done. And Joe has done amazing work. So we have turned him into a local historian, or at least a county historian, and that's a good thing for him to be doing. The County Historical Commission meets 6 times a year, and I have never sat on a commission or a committee where people say, oh, I want to help do that. So the pamphlets and bringing out history is one part. The second part that isn't fully formed yet has to do with history on the land, and we are talking about creating some memorials to some rather significant people who have been in the county. There will be some kind of suffrage memorial that we will suggest to the county. There are 12 places in the county important to the history of suffrage, and we have three very important local women who stepped up to lead that effort when working for suffrage was thought to be a radical, rather low-class thing to do. Because you wouldn't want to be caught doing that. The thing that the anti-suffragists all said is that if she would sell her body, she'd sell her vote. So the people in favor of suffrage had to fight comments like that. So there will be some kind of memorial to the suffrage effort. And we're talking about another memorial probably to a man by the name of Henry Johnson, who was an abolition speaker who went all over the state. He was from Ithaca. He lived here and was the first preacher at the AME Zion Church. Was beaten up 30 times around the state. And so the memorial will be partially to him because he worked for equality. The second person on that memorial would be George Johnson, who was a young man who helped with furthering fugitives who came through the county, people who were seeking freedom and who did not find it here and felt they had to go further for safety. The third person on the memorial will be Frederick Douglass, who spoke twice in DeWitt Park. Once he was beaten up and they had to take him into Village Hall in order to have a safe place for him to speak. And the fourth person on that memorial would be Martin Luther King, who also came and spoke here twice. And so we're thinking of that kind of a cumulative memorial. And I'm not sure what form it will take, but we will bring you back information about it. And I would be really delighted to answer any questions if I could.
Martha Roberts, then Anna.
Yes, 2020 is the 100th anniversary of women getting the right to vote
in the country.
New York State was 3 years earlier. So you mentioned four men. Who are the three notable women that you...
The three notable women. Juanita Breckinridge Bates, who is honored with the Breckinridge House that INHS put up. I'm not sure why they used her. Anyway, so that's what they've done. The second one is Carrie E. Booten, whose husband was a lawyer and was also a newspaper editor. And very courageously, she went from temperance, which was an activity that was respected, to suffrage. And I think it was very brave of her to do that, but was the leader of the suffrage movement in Ithaca and Tompkins County in 1894, got 6,000 signatures for suffrage in 1894, and of course it took many more years before it was passed in New York State. And the third person is Lucy Hawley Calkins, who was the person who led the suffrage effort and then really was the mother of the League of Women Voters and lived here for most of her life. She ended up dying in Rochester, but she really kept that organization going. And the question always is, what did the League have to do after women got the vote? Well, they had a lot to do, and their first effort was to get women on juries. It took till 1937 that New York passed the Kleinfeld Permissive Jury Act, which allowed women to serve on the juries. It was not until 1974 that it was mandated that a jury must reflect the community, and women had to serve on the jury. So it's been a long effort.
Thank you very much for having me.
I just wanted to say thank you first, because I so cherish your passion that you've brought every year that at least I've been here, I'm sure, way longer than I've been here. But I absolutely adore hearing these stories. For me, it keeps them alive. But particularly, you are very articulate and passionate, and I can see it in my mind. I can envision it, and it really is very inspiring. So thank you. And the only question that I did have, the revenues, the $7,750, if you go back to the previous screen, is that
that is what you pay me as county
through STPB, right?
Right.
Yes, that's what I thought.
And it does come from STPB.
That's what I thought. Okay.
And the rest of the money, the $5,000 a year we have asked for and you have given us, and we are now about to go and spend a lot of it on good causes.
Yeah. Thank you for asking.
Henry Branison.
Where will you be located in the new building?
On the first floor, and not in the History Center, but right before you get to it, there's a little, there are three steps to go up to the research room behind the airplane, and if you go up those three steps, there is a glass door, and we're going to have County Historian written on it, and inside we will have furniture, so we can have meetings there, and a desk, and I will work there, and we've been given an absolutely beautiful rug to put on the floor. So we're going to turn it into a scholar's office.
That's a glass door, not a glass ceiling, right?
Thank you.
Carol, thank you so much for your presentation.
Thank you very much. It's a delight to be here.
Okay, we're going to facilities, Zarel Lamaro, and this is Section 4, page 69, and the over-target requests. There are six of them, all recommended, and that's number 68 through 73. Whenever you're ready, Arell.
Okay. Yes, good afternoon or good evening. It's a pleasure to be here to present my 2020 budget to all of you. First slide is just what we do as a department, and I'm sure all of you know that. Our efforts are two areas in capital projects, which occupies most of my time, and then operations on the maintenance and cleaning side, which is our Deputy Director of Facilities, Alan Lockett. Not much has changed funding-wise in our budget from the current year to next year. The increase is mostly increases in salaries. Major influences in our operations side for maintenance and cleaning. Most things are staying the same. No significant changes there. We will be filling our supervisor for cleaning operations this year, so we will have that position filled for all of next year. On the capital side, that actually there's significant changes, as you are all aware. When you reviewed the capital program the first day, that there will be several capital projects in the next several years. And as a result of that, our department is going to need additional technical support in engineering and construction oversight areas. And so my base budget actually includes the addition of an associate civil engineer to meet this need. And you see that reflected in the full-time equivalents from 2019 to 2020, in addition of one full-time position, which is that associate civil engineer position. As I indicated before, my responsibilities almost entirely is capital project oversight and management, as well as running the department. And I've done that for 18 years since we merged the engineering and buildings and grounds divisions to create facilities. Prior to that, the engineering division had four technical engineering or technical positions that did capital projects. Since we merged the two divisions, really the capital programs haven't decreased in volume or size. I've been able to manage that, but it's getting to the point where it's very difficult to manage all of the upcoming capital projects, as well as the maintenance capital projects that we do that are parking lot replacements, roof replacements, fire alarm system replacements. And so that's what this additional position will bring to our department. This is a chart that I've shown probably for 20 years, and the 1 year that I removed it, legislators asked me to put it back in. But it shows the building areas that we maintain. Looking at 15 years, there's been a slight decrease in square footage. As far as costs that we, 15 years ago, $250,000, now it's $260,000 in our operations side. On the bottom, that 57 is 57,000 square feet per maintenance person that they maintain, compared to currently at 46,000. This is on the cleaning side. That stayed fairly stable. The amount of square footage that we currently clean is 340,000 roughly, compared to 323,000 back in 2005, which equates currently to about 19,900 square feet per cleaning person, which is above kind of the industry standard. I have six OTRs, mostly equipment, vehicles, and equipment. And so I'll go through each of them for you. First one is a HVAC maintenance van replacement for our HVAC technician. It's an 11-year-old van, and we're looking at replacing it with a ProMaster Dodge Ram off of the cooperative sites, the best value, that have good prices for vans of this nature. The next one is a zero-turn mower replacement. Of the grounds that we maintain, which are four really large, it's public safety building, health department, emergency response center, I can't remember the other one. Well, there's four. But at least the first two that I mentioned are the largest. We mow them with just one mower. A zero-turn mower works very quickly and is able to maintain all those properties for us. It's 8 years old, and it's serviced by the highway department, and we had some repairs earlier this year, and they strongly suggested that we look at replacing this mower because of the cost and repairs. So we're looking at replacing a very similar zero-turn mower. Where, as I noted there at that last sentence, we are looking for, well, actually this one doesn't reflect it. I made a modification, but it's not reflected here. We are looking at electric mowers, and so we're doing some research to see if it's feasible to use an electric mower. The only concern that we have is the battery life and the power. It may not be enough for the number of properties we have to mow in a day. But we're still doing the research and see if there's anything out there that would be able to meet our requirements.
Shauna, you have a question on that?
Yeah, I have just a general question on the OTRs. Does the amount that you're requesting also take into consideration the trade-in value for the existing vehicles?
No, it does not.
Okay. So there, will that enter into a revenue stream, or will it be less than the OTR that you've requested?
Well, we could use it as a credit towards the price of the replacement mower. There'd be no issue in putting that as a credit towards that OTR.
Okay.
If that's the case. OTR 70 is a replacement for a 19-year-old vehicle, which I really like. I wish I didn't have to get rid of it, but Aaron, that actually serviced all the county fleet vehicles, the last time it barely passed inspection. And luckily they were able to get some parts that were obsolete, but they were able to find them somehow and to allow this vehicle to pass. The body is in pretty good condition. It's just mechanically it's starting to fail. And so we're recommending replacing that vehicle. And we're also looking to see if we can find an electric vehicle that's all-wheel or four-wheel drive for this replacement. The next vehicle, the vehicle number two, would be a vehicle that would be used by the new position that I indicated earlier, the associate civil engineer position, and also would be a similar vehicle. We would research an electric vehicle, all-wheel drive utility vehicle for that vehicle replacement or new vehicle. OTR number 72 is for a 19-foot Genie scissor lift. The lift on the left is one that we've had for 20 years. It's no longer safe. These things on the arms that project out are called outriggers. And we use this a lot at the library, but also at other buildings. The challenge we have at the library is that there's not enough space between bookshelves. And as if you've been to the library, it's a very high ceiling. Well, above the ceiling, the HVAC units are even another 6 feet above that. And so many times we can't locate this right below where the unit is. And then we're trying to use ladders, which is very unsafe when you've got public walking through the library. And so through some of the pest inspections, they've indicated that this lift is no longer safe to use. This lift, as you can tell, is much different than that, but also provides a lot more versatility. It'll fit through an elevator, so it'll fit through this elevator so we can service any of the light fixtures in this space, as well as all of the HVAC and electrical equipment at the library and some of our other buildings. And so this is what is being proposed for replacement for that lift.
Mike.
Are we doing questions at the end, or should we do them as we go?
About particular items, I think you ought to do them right now.
Okay. Two questions, then. Number one, you just said that is no longer safe, the scissor lift. So it would seem to me that we should, purchase that now, literally tomorrow and take that out of service, because you said that a couple of times that it's not safe.
So what we've been doing as of late is renting a lift just like the one on the right.
So we're not using that at all then?
No. I mean, it's unsafe when you can't put the outriggers out. If we're in a space where we can put the outriggers, there's space to do that, then yes, it is safer. But it's a 20-year-old lift, and it's cumbersome to move around, and it has limited use.
Yeah, no, it looks like a pain. But okay, as long as we're not as long as we're not using it, I guess, when it's not safe, that's cool. The other thing is, the county is committed, I guess, to electric vehicles on everything. I know they're going to cost more than what you've got in your thing here. I guess I don't really understand how we move forward as a county if we're not buying electric vehicles. Not my issue, your issue, but I'm not really sure how we do that. So,
well, somebody wants to. We're all part of the legislature, Mike.
I'm saying.
Go ahead.
That was what you're.
Go ahead.
We're researching the electric vehicles for the ones we're proposing. But the OTR does not reflect the cost of an electric vehicle. Those OTRs are for just your conventional. However, I know that the county administration has indicated that they would provide assistance once we are able to either locate an electric vehicle that would meet the needs for our department.
Can you get an electric vehicle for the HVAC van?
No, not that we've found. At least not yet.
Do the best we can.
The last over-target request is for a walk-behind floor scrubber. It's the first one that we've looked at ever purchasing. It would be used on resilient floors, similar to what we have the terrazzo at the historic main courthouse, but also linoleums and vinyl composition tiles that we have at many of our buildings. Right now, to scrub a floor before you either wax it or to clean kind of the upper layers of wax, you have to use a scrubber machine, put a lot of water and chemicals. And so the chemicals is what we're trying to get away from, but also it takes much longer to do the work. With this walk behind, you can scrub the floor without chemicals, and it's dry once you pass over that section, which means we can do the work faster and it's safer, and we can put it back into use very quickly versus the older methods. Challenges ahead is just allocating the limited resources that we have in an efficient way for both managing our capital projects, but also our operations and maintenance of our county facilities while still maintaining and enhancing customer satisfaction. And the one that is always a challenge for us is to increase our preventative maintenance efforts as opposed to always doing unplanned and emergency maintenance, which is always a challenge, is trying to get ahead of that, and we're not always successful.
Questions? Morrell, quite a list of equipment that you're looking for. Tell Tell us about your regular budget. You must have equipment lines in there, and do you have any money built up that you plan to buy stuff with?
Yes.
Why are there so many over targets, I guess is my question.
Yeah, in our operating budget, we have an equipment line for departmental equipment line, which is 5,000. It's usually been that 5,000 range, and it's for things like on the cleaning side for vacuum cleaner replacements. We usually do 5 a year. Carpet extractors. On the maintenance side, it's usually for hand tools, diagnostic equipment. So it's fairly small in nature to accommodate the replacement of equipment such that we've mentioned. And the equipment that I've mentioned here aren't things that we do on a regular basis, I mean on an annual basis. As I said, the Genie lift, it's been 20 years. Mower, it's been 8 years. The vehicles, 19 years. So typically we don't put that on our operating budget. I know many years ago it was discussed the possibility of creating an equipment reserve account where you would put some money annually that would build up. That never really materialized, at least for our department, but that's something that's it's open to consideration.
I can remember that discussion, and it I guess if only $5,000 in your budget, then you have no choice. But
right.
It does seem like a lot of the departments, they try to build up some savings in a reserve account or other things. So it would be kind of interesting to look at that again. Anna.
Given the departments and the responsibilities that you have, I'm assuming you have similar to the highway department, a lot of equipment and vehicles, and maybe that might get more. I don't know what exactly you have, but I'm curious if you have a replacement schedule of all of the larger equipment and vehicles that, like a 5 or 10 year out, that you could then maybe budget how much would be needed instead of coming from reserve?
Those of you that have been on the legislature several years ago, we used to have an equipment replacement plan that we would submit with our budget, and that no longer exists where we would actually do that. We do that internally for our vehicles and equipment. We don't have near the number or size and cost of equipment as highway does. Most mm-hmm. of ours are vehicles, like mm-hmm. I presented here, and this equipment here.
But so if you do it regularly, though, then you know it's coming up, and you know when it's coming up. Would it not be, is it possible to make it a regular or maybe somewhat consistent value that would then go into a target line in your operating budget?
Yes, and that's why I mentioned before the equipment replacement line, equipment or vehicle, that we could create some type of reserve. I'd like to do that.
I mean, actually in the operating budget in target.
Yes, yes.
Has that, Jason, something you guys have talked about?
We haven't talked about it with facilities on the equipment side of things. I mean, I just look back at OTR tracking, and, you know, it looks like you've replaced a vehicle once a year for the past 3 years. It probably would make sense in the future years to probably try to increase target by $50,000 a year. So you're cycling out. You probably have, I don't know, probably a total of 10 vehicles maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, working up the way to replacing 2 a year is probably a fair and reasonable way to go about it.
Yes.
Ral and I haven't had that specific discussion with more on the facility side than on the equipment side.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's preferable at the end of the day. Yeah.
Right.
And that's probably around 75 to 80,000 a year, depending on the size. I mean, some of your trucks are a little bigger, but
yeah,
probably about that.
Right.
Does that sound about right? About $40,000 a vehicle. Yeah.
And one other question: in the budget book on packet page, in section 471, there's in expenditures under utilities, taxes, and insurance. There's an other finance section that was consistently at $315,000, a little over $315,000, and it dropped down this year to $183,500 and change. That's a pretty significant drop. I was wondering what that was about, given it was so consistent for 3 years.
Well, that's a good catch. When I indicated that the the additional position, that associate civil engineer position, is being filled out of our base budget, not as an over target.
Mm-hmm.
That funding is what they called debt service contribution. I think that's right, Rick, what they called it. That was what the money in that account was used to pay off the bond for the energy improvements that we did back in 2005 and 2006. So the last payment is, I think, March of next year. It's twice a year, so we're only needing to make one more payment next year. And so that's the balance of that $315,000. I think is $183,000. I think.
So we literally only have one payment left on that debt it was paying off. Mm-hmm. Rick.
Excuse me.
That's it. That's the end of that bond. Oh, lovely. It just conveniently allows us to hire another staff person. How lovely.
I think Shauna, then Leslin, then Martha. No, Shauna? Then it's Leslin, then Martha.
Pharrell, can you please go back to the cleaning data chart that you had? So I'm making sure I'm following it correctly.
The OTR slides, because they have pictures, are
right.
Slow.
It's all right.
There we go.
And while you get there, I'm trying. How many square foot is maintained per person?
19,954.
As of today. So even though we have sort of increased the square footage of space that we have to clean, they're doing less than they did in 2005, each person?
Well, we have more FTEs now than we did back. Yes. That one,
remember
4 years ago, we brought in a half-time position. That became a full-time position. So
okay.
We're now at 17 cleaners versus 16 that was probably through 2017. We had 16 cleaners. Now we have 17.
So half-time is not full-time.
Correct.
Thank you.
Martha.
Thank you. I'm going to say that same, the graph before it about the square footage that you clean, maintain. Do we clean the history, the Tompkins Center for History and Culture?
No. That's considered an enterprise account, and so that cleaning, we've contracted with a cleaning service to clean that building.
Okay,
so that's not reflected. Well, it's not reflected in the slide that in this slide here. That square footage is for the Center for History and Culture is not reflected there. That's just for our cleaning staff.
Okay. Do we pay for that though? Even if our staff don't do it, do we pay for that?
Contracted out. So it's we contract with a cleaning agency that cleans the Tompkins Center for History and Culture. It's not our staff, and that comes out of that fund.
Okay. All right. On the OTRs, where you've got, I think, the mower, you're hoping for electric. A couple of them you're going to research. But you said the prices here are not for electric equipment, right?
Correct.
So do you have a guesstimate of, what else you'd have to add, and where would that come from if you do find something some of these electric and... it's going to cost more. Is that something you would just...
Two reasons. We could pull it if the capital budget's approved. Remember, that has about $2 million in it for upgrading equipment or facilities. Vehicles, I'm sorry. The other thing is, depending on what it comes in at, it may be easier to do a contingency transfer, because this is not part of the passenger fleet.
Because what?
This is not part of the passenger fleet, which is what that $2 million was intended to for. So depending on what results come out of this, if it's, we probably more likely would come back for a contingency transfer, a one-time contingency transfer.
Okay. All right.
It's unknown, so because these aren't passenger vehicles, it's a little unknown at this point, so they're going to try and do some due diligence and see if it's a worthwhile investment this time around. Most definitely next time around, there'll probably be greater power, greater, durability that they might be needing, but we'll give it a look and give it a shot now.
Okay. And as far as the idea of having going for one-times for equipment as opposed to having an equipment line in the budget? I mean, when I started, we had the equipment line in the budget. Then we went through a recession, and Medicaid bounced, you know, everything out of, completely out of. I think we had a 24% tax levy increase because of Medicaid 1 year, something like. I mean, in that range. So we swept things like budget lines for equipment, and instead departments used their rollover. Rollover is mostly gone now. So that's kind of a little bit of the background about why we don't have what sounds like, oh, gee, that sounds like you ought to have that. Well, we did, and there was a reason that it went away. But so it's certainly something that I guess the Budget Committee should think about, yeah.
I mean, we do it with highway, and we're increasing it this way with highway. Jeff has, you know, considerably larger and more expensive equipment. I know the sheriff's office has a regular replacement of their patrol vehicles, and you know, this is not far off with this in terms of the number of vehicles facilities has. And you know, it's probably something we'll start to get into, putting in programs in place. But you're right, whenever you have a tough budget time, this is usually the first thing that goes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But we still would approve necessary expenditures, but much more on a one-time, case by case, yeah. Okay, thanks.
Anyone else? Ann.
Thank you. So as far as the electric vehicles, so it could be that there's a few years out to be able to get some of these vehicles or the mower electric. I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that at least for the vans, it might be a little while in the other vehicle. As far as paying for them, because you keep your vehicles for quite a while, you know, one option maybe for other departments to help pay for EVs if they're not in their regular fleet might be for the trade-in, but I can't imagine you're going to get much for these vehicles. And just looking for departments when we are, in general, when we are able to get electric vehicles. For commercial, I'm not as sure, but I, in general, you should be able to have half as much as far as fuel costs, or which would be electricity, but so half as much and a lot less maintenance. So maybe that will be juggling the, you know, with the finances to figure that out. I'm sure Rick's all over that, but so I guess one question I had was, because some of those vehicles, when you do your research, that they might be a couple of years. I mean, there's a lot of research and things where there's going to be some trucks out pretty soon, but even the trucks out in the next year or two are going to be pretty darn expensive. They're going to be $60,000-$70,000 for electric vehicles, and I would expect those prices would drop in a few years after that. Would we consider buying used vehicles to tide us over, or does I don't know if that makes sense, because I would imagine your vehicles, especially for the maintenance ones, you have to outfit them with,
yes,
to be able to carry and have
plows for several of them, or racks for HVAC and plumbers and electricians. Yes, true. We have to outfit them.
I mean, I think the goal is to not get to a point to where you're replacing them in 19 years. You know, I think that's kind of I mean, I think that speaks to getting the equipment replacement program back up and running again, looking at the useful life of it. Is it 5 years where you can, you know, transition it out? It very well may be that we can't get electric vehicles this time around, but I would expect it won't be another 19 years next time we replace it.
Okay.
If we can do it this time around, I said next time, you know, I think when you start getting to medium-duty vehicles, I think once you get beyond the five-year life, you start to get into some challenges, and that's probably a healthy, you know, healthy point of looking at replacing it. Mm-hmm. But I would definitely envision us not going 19 years again to replacing the vehicle.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
as long as we can, you know, and financial times change, and that's mm-hmm. pushing this around a little bit, but I think that's the goal.
I mean, as far as the vehicles, say, for instance, for you to use, you know, my Tesla has all-wheel drive, but it doesn't have good clearance, so.
Right.
You get a lift package for it, but we can work on that.
Yeah. We haven't even gotten to the highway yet. Wait till you see that.
Tesla trucks.
Mike.
Henry?
Thank you.
You mentioned that the cleaning historical data, that the mountain is higher than the industry standard. What's the industry standard?
It's more around the 12 to 15,000 square feet per cleaner. Now, that's the average. Some do more and some do less than that 19,954. But yeah, it's less. So it's challenging because we can't always do everything that we'd like to do cleaning wise in our buildings. I know years past we would be compared to the airport for cleaning. Now they spend a lot more per square foot to clean that building than we do for ours. And so it back then it was an unfair comparison. So if you give us more cleaners, more money, we can sure match the quality of cleaning that you see at the airport. But yes, so we would like to get to reduce that cost per square foot number. But at this point, I think we're fine. It's as we add new buildings. So had we had to clean the new building, the Center for History and Culture, then yes, I would have approached you for either a part-time position, half-time or more. To do that, we felt it was better that we outsource that and have a cleaning service do the cleaning of that building.
Burrell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And speaking of more and bigger vehicles, we have Jeff Smith, our highway director here, and he is on section 4, page 92, OTRs 51, 48, and 49, all of which have been recommended in the recommended budget. Jeff, welcome. Folks, we're 10 minutes behind.
That's not bad.
That's
pretty good.
I know, right? 10 minutes. My watch says
10. I don't think it's going that bad.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jeff.
I have for you this evening the Highway 2020 budget presentation. The recommended budget, our budget is broken into two units, highway and highway machinery. As you can see, there's, you know, within target of the 2020 recommended budget. And with the highway machinery, there is a slight increase for the net local at $64,000 on the 2020. That is the exact amount of the OTR that I'm requesting. Major influences, I'm, you know, inclined to speak about this year for 2020. Is really looking at working to provide the same level of service to the taxpayers while maintaining a safe, reliable, efficient fleet of vehicles and equipment. And for that reason, there's a couple OTRs included in this discussion tonight. Another OTR is a program that's underway this year in 2019, funded in the existing but in a smaller way, the county budget. It was developing over the year. It was not known how it was going to be paid for, and when we decided to go with it, it was past budget, so it didn't exist on the budget end of things last year. So that's called the Public Works Apprenticeship Program, and I'm going to talk more about these as the night continues. Yeah, I keep going up or down is the next page. Okay. Full-time equivalent, again, broken into the two units of highway and highway machinery. The highway, again, the increase there, the change over on the right side, let's see, right here, the 4.5 is going to be talked about in greater detail in the next couple of slides, but that is 6 positions for 9 months. That equates to 4.5 FTE. The highway machinery is unchanged, FTE-wise. So the overtime request, as touched on the earlier slides, for the highway is a cost of $44,000. It's at this time a one-time request, and it's in regards to the Public Works Apprenticeship Program. The other OTR that needs to be included with this is to allow the transfer of interfund distribution in order to fund that $44,000. More description here. The Public Works Apprenticeship Program is a shared initiative between Tompkins County, the City of Ithaca, and the Town of Ithaca. The goal of this initiative is to create opportunity for individuals that have an interest in public works career. This OTR creates both a continuation, as I spoke, of the present program, and we are expanding. Presently this year, we got into it with three positions. We're expanding to six next year. We worked it out, and it seems to be really working well this year. At a lot of levels, but in this level, as far as budget goes, the county funds 100%, and then we invoice the town and the city after each 3-month rotation, and they provide the reimbursement. So we're basically sharing the total cost, paying one-third each. And as I said, the other corresponding OTR is to fund the interfund distribution of that. The highway machinery OTRs, we have a mix of things here, and I'm going to try and explain it as clearly as I possibly can. The first one, for the replacement of four pickup trucks at the top, is a one-time, and that is the amount of $64,000. To go on a couple of the questions that I heard earlier, that does include revenue from the sale of four pickup trucks. The revenue you'll see in a later slide is $100,000. The total cost is $164,000. Cost total of the OTR is $64,000 to get four pickup trucks replaced. This money is going to be pulled from our D fund in order to fund that, our reserve, our equipment reserve fund. The next OTR there in the middle, and then the last one is also a interfund distribution similar to the last OTR, but talking about the roadside mower purchase, and I have a nice long description of that coming up, but the that's the difference there that I wanted to highlight at this on this slide, is that it's a target, and in the coming slides I will highlight that greater. So the pickup OTR explains a little further here. That is a pickup existing right now in our fleet that will be traded in. It's a 2.5-year-old vehicle. These are sell for a nice auction price or a very high auction price, and allows us to rotate our fleet every few years. We have a very integrated fleet that we're able to run them. They are never off warranty. They're coming out as they come out. They have all the best safety features. They are the most economical vehicles on the road. This is not the first time that we've looked to do something like this, and we've had a lot of success over the past years doing this. As you can see by the trade, those four vehicles were getting about $25,000 a piece. That put towards the OTR will pay for four new vehicles at $64,000 cost to the county. The other OTR, the different OTR where we're looking for the target, is a roadside mower. This OTR is an amount of $100,000. Some of you may remember from the last 2 years prior to now, this is the last of the three mowers that are scheduled for replacement. The county purchased three mowers all 1 year in 2008. As I spoke in previous years, that equated to all three getting old at the same time, which is a large purchase. So we've worked to break them out and stagger them. And so the other idea with this is that the being going to a target is historically the one-time OTRs have been used to pay for equipment in and vehicle replacement using the funds from highway machinery, as I was speaking with the other OTR on the pickups. For example, the past 4 years, the legislature has approved, on average, roughly $375,000 annually in such one-time OTR requests to support the highway department's replacement of antiquated highway equipment and vehicles. This has been, in addition to the base budget, we have a base budget of $424,000 for equipment and vehicles every year. We're looking to increase this in 2020 by the $100,000. Unfortunately, this practice has depleted the fund balance in the DM fund by more than half in that time period. In 2015, the fund balance was $1.6 million. Currently, the fund balance is $640,000. At this level, using one-time OTRs from the DM fund for equipment replacement may only be possible for another few years. At the same time, the department's equipment inventory replacement scheduling process has identified almost $4 million worth of needed replacements in the coming years. This OTR proposes that the 2020 scheduled roadside mower replacement be funded as a target expenditure, thereby increasing the base budget moving forward in order to better manage regular necessary equipment replacements on the intended five-year schedule, while reducing dependency on the declining and unpredictable highway fund. So with that, I think that the buying power, all of the funds, all the numbers that I put in the budget, I always include the cost to the county, so it has the trade in there. And as well, I'm talking about in reference to a five-year plan in advance throughout the budget process. We did, with the help of staff, put together a five-year plan. So these numbers that are talked about in this kind of oration are pretty accurate as far as age of some of our other pieces of equipment. Our vehicles we've done really well on, as you can see, but some of our equipment's getting older. We're trying to keep up with the most modern, efficient things. Are there any questions? This is the last slide.
Let's take questions. Let's start with Ann.
Thank you, Jeff, for the presentation and the great work you guys do in your department. A couple of questions. I believe the last slide you showed with the mower there, so that's one of the older ones, and I believe one of the newer ones you sent to the Trumansburg Fair. So thank you for doing that.
Okay.
I didn't get to drive it, but I got to climb inside of it.
Okay. This is just a stock photo. It does look just like that.
And so let's see, a couple questions. Wondering if the $100,000 is, as far as increasing the equipment fund, is enough, since usually it's about, the average is $375,000 that you come to us each year.
I think that it's a start. I think going higher, it worked into our plan this year, and looking at our five-year replacement plan, $100,000 gives us a lot of buying power because we're also trading the vehicle. So it's hard to predict exactly what we're going to need every year. I think that, you know, if you want to give me more, we'll take more. But to be fair, I think this is a good start. It's taking our equipment and vehicle replacement program from 424 to 524, and it is getting us through the next few years. If we do go to an OTR situation, it'll be like this year, where it's much smaller, where it's the $64,000 and not the $375,000 that we've been asking. So we're not, and there is still a DM fund, although we don't want to keep hitting it at that large level, but it does give us the ability. There's going to be some years where we replace a grade all, which is a very necessary piece of equipment. It's a $375,000 piece of equipment. You know, those years, maybe we share that price, or a portion of that comes out of the DM fund, and a portion that we're able to handle within our present vehicle and equipment line item.
Anna? Okay.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding this all properly this year. First, Rick, the DM fund, is that the
That's not the same as the D fund that you talk about. Totally different. This is part of their operating operating budget put into an allocation called a DM fund. Yes? Am I getting that right?
They have two separate funds. That's correct.
Okay. Yeah. And how much goes into the DM fund right now per year?
It's, I believe, generated by balances of our highway department that are left at the end of the year that of unspent money.
So it's all rollover?
It's all rollover, but we don't call it rollover at the highway department.
But for my own brain, it's the DM fund is made up exclusively of rollover?
No. So the way your general levy from your general fund shifts to fund your highway fund, which then a portion of that goes into the DM fund, which is your highway machinery fund. That's the DM fund. The D fund is highway. So there's a shift. There's an interfund transfer of funds from general fund to highway, then some from highway to highway machinery.
But that's in addition to the operating budget.
That is your operating budget for highway machinery, because there's really two budgets or two funds. So
that's the budget for highway machinery, but not highway.
Correct. The highway, the DM fund, has a fund balance, which has been slowly dwindling or shrinking because of the large one-times that you're pulling out on an annual basis. So part of this increase in target was to minimize that impact, because I think you probably have, at the rate you're going, probably you're taking more out than it's building every year, probably another 2-3 years. And what Jeff and I discussed was, let's go this year, let's suggest a target increase and see how it goes for a year or so, and if we need to slowly, gradually increase it because it's either not meeting the demands or because the DM fund continues to dwindle in terms of its fund balance, then we recommend an increase.
Just so I understand, though, so every year we have a certain amount that goes from the general fund transferred into the highway fund, which is transferred into the highway machinery fund, and that is a target amount every year, and that is the target you are talking about increasing, which is the interfund.
Yes.
From general to highway machinery, that ultimately will go to highway machinery. 100,000 extra will
correct.
Transfer from the general fund to highway machinery.
That is correct.
How much is transferred every year from general fund as target right now?
So right now, Jeff's highway budget for equipment replacement is 424,000. This would bring it to 524,000.
And so when I'm looking at these numbers, I understand the 44 one time that will come out of this DM fund. Correct?
Okay, the 64, I think it is.
No, 44, which is the...
No, the 44.
The original.
Yes, the 44.
And then there's... Out. Right. And then there is the 64, which will also come out of that. And then there is an additional 100, which will make the 164 total. That's those two. The OTR 49 and 97 are the two that I couldn't quite wrap my head around.
The 44 is the apprentice program.
I know that one. That one I get.
That's coming out of an interfund
totally
distribution.
Get that one. Then there's
that's
the 64.
Only going to highway. It's not going all the way through into the DM fund.
Got it. That one I get. And the other three are for the highway machinery funds. So you have one that's the highway and three that are highway machinery. In the three that are the highway machinery, there's the 64, which is going to replace the four pickup trucks going into that. The 100, which is the increased target, that second one, that is going from the general fund this year, general fund into highway machinery.
Yes. So
right?
this is a little confusing, but it's procedurally it's correct. It's not $200,000. It's just one $100,000. It's got to go. There's a procedure. It's got to follow through an interfund distribution.
Right. So basically, what I'm looking at is the third one is that we're taking from the general increasing target and getting to the DM fund,
yes.
And then the OTR 49 is that it's being used.
Yes.
Just wanted
that's
to make sure
right.
I understood it. I understood that it was an operational thing.
Yep.
I just wanted to follow the flow of money. So thanks for your patience.
Yep. No problem.
Okay, I have Amanda Leslin and Shauna Mike Sigler. Amanda.
Thank you. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how you doing?
Two questions. The first one is about the Public Works apprenticeship program, and I don't know, you may have talked about this in the facilities committee, but maybe could you tell me a little bit more about it? How do you find the people? And this is new, right? So
it was new in 2019.
Okay.
It was put into an actionable program in 2019. It was talked about for a few years prior to that.
Okay.
It includes a cohort, I would say, of public works people from the city and the town, as well as HR people from the city and the town. There's some help from administration that keeps us going and answering questions. The meetings I've been attending have been early on. There was a lot of people in the room, and now we've gone down to maybe 7 or 8 people. Advertising to fill the position is done various methods, through the HR people kind of handle that end of things. We interview. I would say we specifically look for not necessarily people that have experience or background, but have the interest in it, in a career in public works. To just say one more thing without getting too long, is that the rotation is 3 months, and the same people that are at the city go to the county go to the town, and then so we're just rotating around that way. And then within those 3 month time period, they're working at the highway department, they're working with the road crew out in the mechanic garage, with our sign shop, so that with some of the engineers, they're doing some inspections. So they're kind of seeing a whole well-rounded aspect of our department, and that's the same at the city. They're seeing water, sewer distribution, and sewer treatment, streets and facilities and things like that. The town also does. So it's a really well-rounded experience for the individual.
Yeah, that's great. That sounds great. And then my next question is on your FTE page. It looks like you gained a motor equipment operator, but you lost a senior highway crew supervisor. And I was just wondering if there's anything to say about that.
That would be just as people retire and we replace and fill positions as we need. That would be kind of my explanation with that. Those numbers within that overall number, those do vary from year to year, basically for the same reason.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Last one.
Jeff, the Public Works Apprenticeship Program, my understanding, part of the idea behind that as well was to try to attract as many underrepresented folks as we can possibly do, not only folks who might not have any experience at all but are interested, but underrepresented folks. And I wonder, given this sort of first run pilot, if you can speak to any success in attracting those kinds of folks to the positions.
There was a focus of that underrepresented groups, and we had a great success with the three positions in obtaining that goal under the present program.
Okay. Ann?
Jeff, and also address this to all the legislators. So we, from the town of Ulysses, they passed a resolution in support of increasing the money that is in our highway department to take better care of the roads. And I know that, so that's dramatic music. I didn't plan that. That just happened. So therefore, I know that a few years back, and I don't know if I have the numbers correct, but a few years back, maybe 2005, there was some more money put in because the condition of the roads was maybe 62% as far as, grading, how from a scale, I think, from 0 to like 100, 100 being like the best possible condition a road could be in. And I think around that time it was like 62%. but now with some more investment, they're up to about 75%, and you're going to continue to invest to get the roads even in better condition. But I'll let you correct me on that.
I believe it was 2013.
2013.
We started with the original five-year maintenance bond funds that were added to the highway. And that was 5 years, and we've recently raised that up to, well, that was $1.2 million. Now it's $1.8 million that we receive annually for road maintenance. It has helped greatly. We're able to do miles of preservation of roads and improve roads much more than we were with our base funding, with our base target budget as well.
And as far as the condition,
condition is now at 72.5, and last year it was at 70.
And when you started, it was in the 60s, right? 5 years
ago? 62-something.
62? Okay.
In 2008, and that was a decline. And there was a lot of things. There was really expensive diesel prices, and cost mm-hmm. of asphalt was enormous, and we were kind of dwindling at that time. And I mm-hmm. think that everyone was recognizing that and realized we needed to do something.
Okay. So I promise, because the town of Ulysses is in my district, I promise that I would follow up and bring this up, and I feel confident that we're doing what we need to be doing.
Thank you. Shauna.
Hey, Jeff. I wanted to thank you for increasing the number of people that we're going to have for the apprenticeship program. I've heard that it's been successful, as well as in Health and Human Services Committee, we talked about Ban the Box as well as Beyond Ban the Box. And one of the programs that we can do in order to support Beyond Ban the Box is having apprenticeship programs. And they used the county as one of those examples. So thank you for expanding that.
I'm glad to be part of it, but I'm not going to take all the credit.
That's all right.
I'm just the messenger. There's a whole lot of people behind helping the whole thing be successful.
Great. The other question I had was based on the four trucks that were going to be purchased. I wanted to know, do you purchase those trucks new?
Yes.
Okay. I guess I'm struggling a little bit with only having them for 2.5 years. It seems a bit extravagant to trade in a car after 2.5 years. Certainly in my family, we run them to the ground and then we walk them in. We can't even drive them in. And so I wanted to know, like, financially, does it make sense to trade them in after 2.5 years?
Yes,
is there something different with trucks or?
Very intentional.
Yeah, the buying power is our ability to buy off state contract is well below sticker on these trucks, and I could get you the details average. That gives us the ability to run them for a few years and then sell them, and then your auction value. I look at this number, the 64,000. If one of us goes to buy one of these trucks, one is 64,000 down at one of the local dealerships. The way that we equip them, there's a plow included, everything. So it gives us the ability to have these trucks rolling. In the past, I've done research on what our cost is per mile to own these for those 2 or 3 years, and that cost per mile is very low. It's under 40 cents. There was like four models I looked at. One had been in a small accident, rear end, not our fault, and so there was some extra cost to that one, so that was like a little bit over 40, and the rest of them were like 35 to 38 cents per mile. The national average is 65 cents per mile, and cost of if you keep them longer, that will continue to rise, because now you're putting on, you know, more expensive repairs and parts and batteries and starters and other things. And then when you go to your resale is then decreased because it's an older vehicle with higher mileage. So we try and manage this program very closely, and I think it's been very successful.
And then I guess my other question is to Rick and Jason, does it make sense to do this for the other departments?
It depends on the type of vehicle. The medium to heavier duty, pieces of equipment will get a greater return on investment for a shorter use. So in this case, is that a 350 or a?
These are one ton 350.
Yeah, so these are a heavier duty truck, which, having 2.5 years, limited mileage, it's under warranty. I think one of the things you left out is it's still under warranty, which is huge. With a passenger vehicle, it may not get the same return. So I think one of the things we have to look at, particularly with, when we start looking at electric replacements, is, you know, is a five-year replacement average, is it 2.5 years going to get that type of return on it? And I think the larger the vehicle or a piece of equipment, the more expensive it is, the quicker the turnaround, you're going to get a much higher resale. So in this case, he's buying four F-350s that have plow package capacity for $64,000, which I agree with you. You know, that's a pretty low price point per truck. And being able to, so a lot of communities are doing this because you buy it off a state bid, you're buying it at a much below sticker price. You're turning around quicker, you're getting great resale. So purchasing a brand new one for, you know, less than $20,000 is a great return. If we were to do that with a Chevy Volt, I don't know that it would be the same. So it's also a fleet management issue. You know, you're talking about 70 plus vehicles managing versus four or whatever, you know, right. Much smaller. So one of the things we've talked about as we go into this next stage of replacement is how do we manage the fleet, which may talk about a bigger discussion and may get onto that. But right now, you're seeing the larger equipment, if you, the quicker you turn around, the more resale you're getting out of it, and may allow you to replace it at a lower cost point.
Great. Yeah. Thank you.
Mike Sigler.
My next question is more of a philosophical question, and Jeff, you're free from this because it's more to Jason. We keep talking about replacement, yes, and selling these trucks. I mean, should we really be even talking about that? I mean, under Barack Obama, we did cash per clunkers. These are clearly gas-driven vehicles. I mean, if we're replacing them with electric vehicles, which we aren't this time, but we may next time, I mean, are we really going to count on that resale value? Because if we just replace them with electric, but then we sell them, they're still on the road. So we really, we're not doing kind of our mission statement. That's what I'm asking.
Right. So I don't have an answer to that philosophical question. that's more for the legislature to address. What I can say is I think over the next 5 years, equipment, particularly as we get into Jeff's stuff, is going to change when you start talking about upgrading into electric use. And that's going to force some different conversations to take place. So if you notice, this initial transition until 2025 is really only passenger vehicles. And frankly, I don't think it's going to be economically feasible to get into Jeff's equipment electric-wise in the next five, probably closer to 10 years. When that happens, that's a philosophical decision as to what you want to do with those vehicles. Do you want to decommission them? Do you want to sell them? I can't answer that question. If that's a question you guys want to pose to us, we'd be happy to look into it for you. But right now, there's a specific purpose why we didn't try to tackle public safety vehicles or large highway equipment, because the technology doesn't exist to make it cost effective. The larger, beyond that, philosophical discussion is up for you guys to figure out.
Okay, we've got some second bites here. Anna and Amanda and Martha, I don't think you've spoke yet. Why don't you go?
Okay, well, yeah. Tell you what, let's bring back Barack Obama and then we'll do the cash for clunkers. How's that?
Let's stay on topic.
We're not doing that.
All right, now my question was really Shauna's, because we're driving to the ground school too. But Jeff has given me that lecture a few at the Ithaca Festival parade a couple of years ago, and it really does make sense. But I'm glad we're going to wrap it into the bigger conversation about the fleet as we go through it. So I appreciate the. You know, it was really, I raised my hand before Shauna had that question. Thanks.
Anna and Amanda, fairly quickly.
Yeah, Jason actually made most of my comments. I appreciate it. One was the warranty comment. I think we really do need to remember that. But the rate of buying and selling, you figured out a very tight mathematical equation. At one point, you presented that to us at facilities, I remember, and gave us a presentation. I was wondering if you still had that, because to see it all mapped out answered every single question anybody could have had about it. So it might be worth sharing with everybody so that they understand that there's a sweet spot for all of this based off of money and technology and usage and buyback and every single component you factored in, every single component. I was very impressed. So I just wanted to share that. That was very helpful for me a couple of years ago.
I don't remember being that detailed, but...
Well, for me it was. It was my first year on the legislature. I was very impressed. Yeah. And the other
the other thing I forgot, so we'll move on. Thanks.
Amanda?
I was just going to go back to the philosophical question and say that I definitely hear you, Mike. I mean, why are we buying any new equipment? Why do we buy, you know, anything? And purchasing new machinery means that you're using fossil fuels to build those machines. And if it was up to me, I would say, yeah, let's not do it. But that's not what we're in the business to do. And I think we've made a statement about our policy and our green policy as a legislature, and we're taking the first step. We're doing what we can do, and it's one step at a time. So, but I hear you, and it's a good discussion.
You have to, Anna?
I just remembered my other thing that I just want all of us to remember moving forward for the rest of the other presentations, is that we as a legislature, Mike, are in that really uncomfortable place that, unlike most other counties, we are on the cutting edge and we're racing technology in all of these. So it is a balancing act. As Amanda said, we have the philosophy, but then we're chasing it. So I just think we need to keep that in mind.
Our process is questions. And we're not debating things.
It's
this process.
Hopefully going to save time in the future, Mike.
You know, when we replace the newer ones, they usually are more economical. They're more energy. You know, they're more efficient. They burn clean. You know, they're burning cleaner. We've changed over diesel fuels. So, I mean, you are making incremental steps to do that, and you do it the best you can with what you have, and we'll go from there. I'm sure over the next decade, things, the truth of the conversation will change drastically.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation tonight.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Jeff.
We are now 25 minutes behind. And we have to turn to our sheriff, Derek Osborne. Derek's budget is in section 4, page 170. He has 7 over target requests that have been recommended.
Okay. Thanks for having us here tonight. We'll still give you our full 30 minutes, if not more. I was hoping that meant when they went over that we only had to be up here 5 minutes. But,
well, you didn't happen to talk any green technology. We covered that now.
Right. Good. And if I knew I could ask for a scissor lift, boy, tonight would have been a whole different story. Our budget, as you'll see, isn't changing drastically other than the staffing requests we have going on. Jen and I are going to kind of work together. She's going to start off on the first several slides, and then I'm going to save my energy for the staffing questions that I'm sure there's going to be several of. There we go.
So I'm just going to take this time to just talk about a few of the things that are influencing our expenditures and revenues in each of the lines. You'll see that it's broken up into two separate units, so to speak. The law enforcement and civil units are together, and then the jail will follow. I'm assuming you guys have this PowerPoint, so I'm going to go off this slide just to talk about a few of the changes that might bring notice. If you could hit this down there. First thing we'll talk about are some of the influences that are we have on our sheriff's office expenditures. There's been an increase in family court paperwork services, which you'll see in the revenue influences kind of offsets. We've had an increase in family court paperwork, but we don't bring in any revenue. It increases the amount of work our civil deputy has to do without bringing in revenue to match that, as well as some changes in New York State law that makes it harder for residents to file civil paperwork themselves. And when that civil paperwork is served outside of the county, we no longer could receive that revenue. That revenue goes to the county where that person is residing. So those are a few of the changes in the civil world. Road patrol, we still have staffing absences as a result of 207C and disability, as well as military leave. You'll see a recommended staff increase of 2 deputy positions. One we're funding through the sheriff's office budget itself. We'll kind of discuss that in a little while, as well as an adoption of the position into the FDE roster, the Stop DWI coordinator, as well as an over-target request for vests. So those are the few of the things that are influencing our expenditure lines from 2019 to 2020.
you go to the next slide.
Next, a few of the things that are influencing our line through revenues for the sheriff's office, law enforcement, and civil. Again, decrease in revenue from family court paperwork, increase in pistol permit processes. We went to plastic permits. The revenues kind of offsetting the costs there, so to speak. Law enforcement, you could see there's a move from fines and forfeitures into the confidential investigations expenditure. That's just our attempt to not have to move money around towards the end of the year. Confidential investigations is, so to speak, buy money, which we would take out of the forfeiture line anyway. So that's kind of the movement there, kind of offsets one another. And there was an analyzing prior year's revenues from the airport, it was decided that we could comfortably increase that by $10,000. And then our biggest changes in revenue and expenditures in those lines is coming from the adoption of the Stop DWI coordinator. You could see in 2019, they were set to take in $104,000. It decreased to $52,000 in 2020. So that's where that drastic difference in revenue is coming from when you see our budget, as well as a decrease from $8,000 to zero and $5,000 to zero from 2019 to 2020. The Stop DWI coordinator would obviously be a new position for us to undertake, so I might not have specific answers if you have questions about why those things happen, but I think someone here could probably answer those. So we've got to move on to the jail. So move on to the jail. Things that are influencing the expenditures there, again, as the road, staff absences because of 207C disabilities, as well as military leave, those aren't anything new. In 2019, we received a medication-assisted treatment grant, which we'll see will affect the revenue as well. That grant went towards overtime staffing, the actual medication itself, travel training, extra hours for the psychiatrists. That was in 2019, which is not in 2020, so you'll see a difference in expenditures and revenues because of that as well. And we'll discuss that a little bit further on the next slide. Other things that are influencing the expenditures is our over-target request for EMAR, which is an electronic medication administration record system, as well as bulletproof vests for the jail staff. On to revenue, we had phone commission revenue. We also had a tower detail to build an AT&T tower on Sheriff's Office location property, so there was revenue brought in 2019 that there won't be in 2020. As well as you could see, there were two MAT grants, one for $12,000 and one for $48,000, which would add up to the $60,000 difference in revenue between 2019 and 2020. And that's kind of a wrap-up of what things are influencing our expenditures and revenues for both units from 2019 to 2020. Now I'm going to turn it over to Derek to discuss our staffing and OTR.
Perhaps I'll offer, is it best to get questions out of the way up to this point, or should we go right into...
Questions on the budget? Okay, yes, there are. Dan, then Martha.
So let's see. My question is about the DWI coordinator, and I heard you just say that you don't know about the past of the program. But I guess for anybody, I'm a little confused about what's happening with this position. It's expanding, or
sure.
I know it's transferring departments.
Yep. And we'll have it slotted also at the next public safety committee meeting to get into the full background to it. Essentially, the Stop DWI program was self-funded for quite some time based off of the revenues generated from DWI cases and so on and so forth. And over the past 5 to 6 years, that revenue statewide has been dwindling pretty significantly to the extent that it no longer self-funds or self-sustains itself. In the past, during the time when there was significantly more revenue, it also helped to support portions of DA positions, which you have since, well, I think last year we pulled out, and this year you made a target back in the DA's office. With the decrease in the revenue and plus a kind of an evaluation of its location in my office, which really doesn't coincide a lot with what goes on in my office, we got together and talked about where it's the proper home for the position. When we started to dig into the details about some of the different functions, there's an interlock monitoring that this position oversees with respect to misdemeanor DWI cases. And also talking with the sheriff and the undersheriff about administrative needs in their office, what we decided to do is we can shift some of the interlock monitoring, actually all the interlock monitoring, over to the probation, because they do interlock monitoring for probationers. So in this sense, it's a similar function that they already provide, which will free up time and availability to assist the sheriff's office with more administrative functions. So the Stop DVI program still continues to have an educational promotion function to it. There's also a grant program, and where they administer funds for either details or for grant work, that'll continue. But hopefully with the shifting of some responsibilities, it'll also open up the opportunity to assist the undersheriff and the sheriff with different administrative functions that they have in the office.
Can I just follow up a little bit?
Go ahead.
Is the Stop DWR coordinator, is that a mandated program?
I don't know. That's a good answer. A good question. I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we have Martha, Anna, Leslie, and Ann.
So to follow up on that, I know it's been dropping for a while. I mean, are people not driving drunk? I know that's not right.
But. Yeah, I really don't have a good answer for that. I would like to think that, yeah, maybe there is a decline in driving while intoxicated. It's definitely an effort in law enforcement we've been attacking for years and years and years. So it's only, I would only think that maybe it has had some impact, but I'm not really
sure.
Do we
have fewer of those checks, those sobriety checks? I mean,
well. I think it's several things. Number one, there's been changes in the way the state has increased its fee structure, which meaning they're getting some different surcharges when fees are issued, which doesn't mean that more fees are issued to an individual. It just means that the state's getting the first cut of fees, which means we're getting less cut of fees. Some of it. I will say that some of it is probably the availability and enforcement across the state. I mean, when you look at the number of felony charges, they've dropped, and part of that is lack of details, which goes back to lack of funding availability for details. So it's hard to say that there's less of it going on. There's just less, in this case, that I think there's been arrests with it. And some of that has to do just with across the state, you're seeing just changes, the less specificity with it.
I think it's important to add, to support what Jason's saying, is, we used to get significant funding to put on these details, and we just haven't seen that in years. And yeah, there has been less enforcement, at least at the sheriff's office. There's less roadblocks, things like that. Will there be more grant funding in the future if we show better numbers? Possibly.
Yeah, I mean, it's availability too. If you go through a stint where you've got a certain amount out on 207 that are out of service, and you're already strained from overtime perspectives, and that may ebb and flow. But I think it's across the state you're seeing a drop in Stop DUI funds, and part of it is the way some of the state fees and surcharging is taking place. Okay. I know Lisa Holmes will have more on this at the public safety meeting. She got into a pretty good analysis of it to talk a little bit more details to why the revenue is dropping.
Okay, and I want to ask about the phone commission revenue. Is that where inmates are charged to make phone calls?
Yes, it is. Yes.
So we talk about this every so often, Jen, I'm sorry, you said it was going. The revenue was going up. Our line here doesn't say.
No, revenue's going down. Some of those things offset one another with the phone commission, and now the tower detail going away, the one-time MAT grant going away. So those are kind of things that are increasing.
So what's happening to the phone rates? What's the rate per minute?
These are just things that we're talking about that bring in revenue, or the revenue that's getting taken away each year. So there's not necessarily anything significant happening with the phone commission revenue. It's just something to consider that is a revenue line that influences that.
Yeah, I can't say, Martha, what the phone rate is currently. I don't recall. We've had several conversations regarding this actually very recently with some legislators. We all have feelings about, impacting the inmates, or the impact it has on them, charging them for phone calls. Unfortunately, it is in our budget as a revenue, so it is used in such a way. So that's certainly something we're open to conversations with ongoing.
I would like us to, or at least maybe if public safety has already talked about it recently, we could get an update because I think it's something...
We've talked about it, but not recently.
Okay.
It would be a good subject.
I mean, if it's something like, okay, we need to add $10,000 to your budget so that inmates can pay a normal charge for phone rates, then I can do that. I can justify
that. There's no doubt the price is very high.
Right, I know. Okay.
Anna?
Thank you.
I have to admit, it got to a point where I sort of threw my hands up because there's so much moving around that at some point you have to just trust. Yeah. So there's a lot of lines, but I didn't even fully understand, this conversation. So I personally would love to see maybe a little bit more about the slide that you have about the jail medical board out revenue influences slide that you were talking about with Martha just now. Not here. We don't need to go into that. The one you were just on. But in particular, the one that I was interested in is the one-time medication-assisted treatment grant. Is this going away? Is that? Am I misunderstanding?
My understanding was it was a one-time grant. Mm. Yes.
And it was a one-time grant from the state. Were they looking for an internal implementation, or that local municipalities would take over, that it was supposed to design something that would then be in place, or was it just a pilot? Or
My understanding is that it could turn into a reoccurring grant, but at that time it was just a one-time grant. I think Ray is meeting with the health department because they're the ones who actually take in the grant initially, and we have to talk about ways to analyze that to be able to propose to the states so that the grant could continue. But for now, it's just a one-time grant.
So there was data that they had us collect to show potential effectiveness.
Well, that they want us to collect, not that we have, because it's still new, and I think they're still developing what kind of data they actually want us to collect.
Got it. And the DWI position, given that we're changing the nature of that position, my understanding after reading all of this is that out of your budget, some of the cost of that position would come out of your operating budget. Am I wrong about that?
I would say that no matter what happens, whether the position were to stay in the county admin or shift up there, the revenue generated from the program is not self-sustaining.
That I get. That
so essentially, it's an OTR to shift the position over to target funding.
So then it would be it's an OTR, a target OTR that would be permanent to support half of the. I'm sorry. What I understood from reading it was that the $52,000, that is the existing fees that we'd still get, which is half of what it used to be,
right,
will pay for the program.
Yes.
And that the cost of the position is the OTR that's a target.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure I understood, and that this will be part of your budget and part of the responsibility will shift into general admin for the department.
Yeah, in working this out with Jason, we definitely identified from our end a need for more administrative staff, and this was an idea actually Jason came up with, which I thought was a really good one, to incorporate the DWI program into the sheriff's office, but also make that person responsible for helping us with other grant work that we do that kind of gets dispersed amongst the agency, and it makes it very difficult. So hopefully the person in that position can help in that regard as well and also give us some more support in the civil office.
And then the other OTRs are going to be part of your second presentation. Is that correct? Okay, I'll hold off.
Right.
Yeah.
We've got Leslin, Ann, Rich, Shauna, Mike. Leslin.
Yeah, I can't follow the bouncing ball either. So does the DWI position no longer get grant funding?
Because
that position used to get a big grant.
It's not grant funding. It's fees generated from...
No, I understand the fees. I'm saying that there used to be a grant that came with that position, and it's one of the things that helped fund the position. So we no longer get that.
There's a very small $5,300 grant that would come in that would offset the interlock monitoring costs with the position, and that has been shifted over to probation. Outside of that, I don't know if there was, historically, I don't think there was a large grant. I think it was always fed off fees.
Yeah, there was a grant.
Okay, then I'd have to know a little bit more about the history. Leslie.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
So what I'm hearing is that there's no funding there and we have to make it a target position.
Can I ask why? Why do we... Is it just a matter of what the sheriff and you talked about, that there's some support will be there, that we have to make it a target position? Or is it something that's going to help at this point?
I would say if it stayed in my office, you would have to make a target to sustain the position. And looking at the duties and talking with the sheriff and talking about what their needs are, it seemed to be a good way of being able to shift personnel. And frankly, in my office, it doesn't necessarily coincide with all the stuff that we work on a regular basis.
No, I got that part. I want to make sure that I'm very clear in saying I'm not advocating for getting rid of the position.
Yes.
I was just asking why we saw the need to make it a target position at this point, and I think I understood it. Jen, you talked about the tower. Is that the phone tower thingies? You said the revenues are going away?
Yeah, well, right now we bring in revenue because they have to pay a correction officer to be out there while they're doing construction or maintenance. So that's decreasing over the year.
Okay. So then this is a question for probably Jason or Rick. Because the phone companies are using our towers, we do get some revenues off of that, correct? As we used to.
We do. I don't know the amount. I'd have to get back to you on that. I'm certain when we do, because we have some type of lease with Verizon and so on and so forth.
Right.
I don't know the exact revenue, and I don't know what budget line it's under.
That's fine.
Okay.
That's fine. As long as that wasn't what Jen was referring to, that's going away.
Yeah, no, that's not it.
I was just wondering. And the deputies are at the airport. The agreement with the state, federal government, whoever it was that they would reimburse us, and we knew that had been dwindling over the years. They were supposed to be 100% reimbursement, then we went down to 90%, then I think we ended up at 75%. Where are we now? Are we getting any money back for the deputies who are working at the airport?
Yes.
Do we know how much we get back percentage-wise? Do they pay for the whole thing still, or...?
Overtime.
Yeah, my understanding is they pay for the overtime, and the reason we're seeing that change is because we are actually receiving more back from them than we have been lately, and that's why we were comfortable increasing that line.
Thank you.
That's what you're getting at, Leslie.
Thank you very much. I'll wait for the next half.
Okay, yes, we got another half of this department to talk about, and we've got two more departments, so keep that in mind on your questions. We've got Ann, Rich, Shauna, Mike, and Martha again.
I'll try and be quick. The phone call costs that the people who are incarcerated pay, I second what Martha said. I don't know if how arduous that would be to get the costs, to see if that is something that we might consider putting in the budget at some point to help offset that. So it would be like, say, the overall cost, and then, for instance, the cost per minute, so we can kind of get some real figures. And then, and you don't have to answer that now, whether you can get it. So the second thing and the last thing is you have some people out on disability, and this was possibly discussed in public safety. If it was, we don't need to discuss it here, but has it been discussed whether the people out on disability, if they're out, say, on road patrol or they're officers in the jail, that they could do less demanding tasks, physically demanding tasks?
Well, that's always a double-edged sword, to be honest with you. In the jail, we've always had issues with assigning people to light duty in the jail environment. They're locked in, they're in with the inmates. There is a possibility they could get hurt interacting with inmates, so we've really never really done light duty in the jail over the years. On the road patrol, we've looked at that differently. Some of the concerns that come up, and we have done light duty on the roadside. My understanding is if they're in there for a certain length of time, sometimes that could become their job duties, and then we're kind of stuck with them in that capacity, and that is a position we don't want to be in either. So recently, to back that up. And the jail side, we have three out on disability or 207C. At least two of them have been out for several years. We have been working with Jason, Lisa Holmes, and we are trying to get them out on retirement. So hopefully that'll free up. But, you know, that takes a year or two once the paperwork's filed. So we are stuck with that for a long time. On the roadside, we had one deputy that was working light duty for a long time. He was coming to the office 1 hour a day for once a week, I think, or twice a week. It was ridiculous. I couldn't even find work for him to do in an hour. Time he came in and turned on the computer, it was time to turn it off. So we stopped that practice to try to urge that retirement. Yeah, it's not always a good thing to make them work light duty, unfortunately. Sometimes it gets them back to work quicker, but not always.
Thank you for the explanation.
Sure.
Thanks. On the Stop DWI coordinator, we had a visitor to public safety from New York State come in and talk about the traffic safety boards. And her message to us was essentially that we weren't really out there soliciting grants, and that if we did, we could generate some real revenue for the county. Is it your intent with this move to emphasize that and have the Stop DWI coordinator chasing these grants?
Yeah, in the past when I was undersheriff, I was constantly seeking out grants and trying to apply for them. I don't think that's really been the practice lately. Yeah, that would be a great help in that area. There's grants not just with Stop DWI that would help in that area, but all kinds of grants. So hopefully we would benefit as a county from that.
The visitor seemed to say that the position could be self-sustaining. If what's your sense? Is that too optimistic?
I think it's not optimistic. I think it's maybe too early to tell. I think time will tell. That would be a great goal to have, and I would certainly push for that, sure.
Thank you.
Shauna.
So I know that, I believe it was back in March, Rikers Island actually went where all of the inmates received, were able to make free phone calls. And the nonprofit that was instrumental in that, we did have a conference call with them. And we talked about the revenue that we were receiving, if there's any way that we could kind of turn that around and, you know, somehow not as a county receive revenue from inmates. Felt not great for all of us, right? And I think one of the things that perhaps we can discuss more in public safety is if there's negotiation to be had with the phone company, because it seems like all of the rates throughout the state are much different and vary on how much they're charging the inmates. And I think also, and we can also talk more about this in public safety, but I have heard of other jails that instead of accepting revenue, they allow a certain amount of free minutes per inmate whenever they first come in. So that might also be another alternative so that we're not accepting revenue on behalf of the inmates. Secondly, I wanted to ask about the medical assisted treatment. I wanted to see if whenever inmates come in and they're currently on a MAT program, if we are able to provide those medications while they're in our jail.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it would be new people who are not currently on a MAT program that are not, that we no longer have funding for with the grant?
No, this was about reporting and monitoring and...
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to confirm, anyone that comes into the jail is eligible for medication-assisted treatment?
Yeah, they would be seen by the doctor, and it would be a case-by-case basis and determined by him.
Absolutely. Okay, great. Thank you.
Mike Sigler.
I'll be quick. First off, thank you for being in the parade.
Yeah.
Lansing had a parade. It was great.
It was a lot of fun.
Led the parade, in fact. When you took over the job, you had a there was kind of a deputy shortage in part because of disability. There were like six deputies, I think, on disability. Has that resolved itself at all?
Some of them have, some of them haven't. Like I said, right now on the road patrol side, we have two deputies out. One has been on disability or 207C long term. The other one is a more recent case that I don't anticipate that deputy either coming back or if that person does anytime soon. As you know, we also have the one facing trial that started today. That person has been out for a long, long time on administrative leave. So we're still hurting, but it's not the situation that existed, I believe, in 2016.
Cool. Thank you.
Martha and Anna would both like a second shot. We're due for a break, and we have a second half of this this presentation. So, Martha and Anna, please be brief.
I'll be really good, Mike. My questions were already covered.
Great. We like it. Anna?
I just had some math, Jason, on the new sheets you just gave us.
Yes.
Section 4, page 172. It had a fringe benefit of 30,000 and something that's now negative 244. Was that just a switched? It looks like it was switched to law enforcement fringe. Was it just a mistake that it went into the wrong fringe?
I will let Kevin.
Kevin?
Explain that.
Yeah, this was the one I described earlier where I had, when I was helping the department with the OTR, I had a typo and I misdirected the fringe into the wrong bucket.
And then the other one, thank you, that helps, on page 174 on program expense. In 2019, it was $4,600. The target for this year is $35,000. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering what that jump was due to. Was that the DWI?
Right. So this is a situation where last year's budget, the program expense, which is really the grant portion of this, was really shrunk down, and due to the change in revenue. And this year, putting the, you know, funding the position through Target and emphasizing the program expense piece, which is really the distribution of grants to different law enforcement agencies
in
the county.
Taking it out of staff.
Yeah, so there was a shortcoming in the program expense line over the past several years, and I think it really fits best under the sheriff's office. I think it'll be revived. I think you'll see more administration of these programs. I think the local law enforcement agencies will be more receptive to it, and I think we'll get it back up on its feet a few years ago. So,
thanks.
I would just add one thing also. You know, the 207C disability piece is something that I think over the past several months we have really tried to focus on to get these folks back to work or get them retired. It is something that I think has lapsed. I know in early spring I spoke with HR about changing some of that, and I know Lisa, now coming on board, has really started to move some of those forward, and trying to, moving forward, if we have those cases, staying on top of them consistently, regularly. I just think that fell by the wayside a little bit, and you know, we're reviving our approach to suicide and disability to get folks back to work, so that we don't have long absences or frequencies in it.
We're going to take a very brief break. How about 7 minutes?
Sure.
That's awesome, dark chocolate crisp.
The little houses?
It is. Jim's house, and I thought.
No, he actually dedicated them to me. Yes, I felt as the housing person.
Whoa. I was riding around the lake. I wanted to go. Mickey went by. This was the kickoff for the fundraiser. Okay.
This is really good.
Okay. That's really good. Have you updated the website?
Well, we've
I
son.
$30 off.
$30 out of $191 million?
Come up with that.
You're $30
Come
off, dude.
Yeah,
these are still the right lines.
I'll be okay with that.
Just wanted you to know.
Yeah, email me or something.
I figure that comes to $888, and this was $881, that's $851. These OTRs. I'm going to go back through, and because these are the white ones, I'm going to say maybe they changed to the yellow ones. But No, but these numbers don't equal this number, and these numbers are in the white pages. So just I'm gonna go back through to let you know.
$30 off.
Trying to fill that void day to day.
Send a negative message.
We'll get through it.
The lines are still accurate. Probably.
Sheriff Osborne.
Thank you. I don't have any slides for this. I passed out a document for all of you to take a look at it, maybe read it in your spare time or read it next year if you want to. I just gave that to kind of support where I was coming from or where we were coming from in our request. You'll see that, you know, we did initially put in our conversation with Jason several more positions. You know, I like to think there's always what we need. There's also what we really, really need and really, really want. We're getting with this increase what we need. We've had really good conversations, pulled a lot of stats, and that's basically what I provided you. You know, it starts off way back in 2003 with that darn study from DCJS. We've talked about that before. Several of us have. You know, the accuracy of that and all that. I can't argue with that. So I kind of just use that as a starting point. And, you know, and over the years, moving up through the ranks over several years, I could always feel and know what we needed, but I could never really articulate that until I started looking at some of the stuff we came up with, population increases over the years, housing increases, increases in our call volumes, and also the feeling we had of diminishing our patrol, so to speak. As a lot of you know, over the years, we've had to remove two different deputies from our road patrol to handle administrative functions. One is doing that exclusively now. Another one was removed to handle narcotics investigations because we couldn't seem to keep up with that. And, of course, that impacts our road patrol. And then it spirals even farther downhill, and we stop putting out our boat patrol, we stop putting out snowmobile patrols, things like that, and now we're to the point where we have so many traffic complaints in different neighborhoods we can't seem to keep up with. I'm sure, I know some of you receive them from your constituents because you fill me in on it, and then we try to do our best to handle that. So I'm not going to go on and on about that. I'll certainly answer any questions you have, and I'll let you read the document at your leisure and answer questions in the future if you have them. But at this point, you know, outside the Stop DWI position, it looks like we may be receiving. That, again, is really going to help us in the civil office keep up with that. We did lose a position in that office several years ago when we got the Spillman Records Management System. We thought maybe we wouldn't need that position. Really hasn't shown to be that. We're behind in our UCR reportings with the state by several years, and we're trying to catch those up now. So that brings us down to the two deputies we're asking for. One is... excuse me. So the three full-time equivalents that we're asking for, one, again, is the position from the Stop DWI program. Another one is a deputy on the road patrol that is coming out of our own budget. We've been able to save in a lot of areas. I'm very proud of the fact that through August of this year, our budget for overtime on the road patrol was at $410,000. We've only spent $185,000 through August. We've really tried to tighten up what we're doing with road patrol and making sure that every dollar counts and we're getting what we pay for. So that's going to help with funding the second position. I'm sorry, the first position we're funding out of our budget. The second position is new funding, obviously. Is it best to just have you... start asking me questions, I can explain how we plan to use those two positions.
Finish your presentation, then let's take questions.
Yeah, I'm just going to add that in meeting with Jason, the undersheriff, and I, we tried to be as creative as we could with these positions. I know staffing costs a lot of money. And the two deputies that we're asking for starting next year is really will go a long, long way in what we can do. What we considered was, if you've been on any of the negotiating sessions, our contract reads that for the road patrol, we have to approve time off down to three deputies. Why that got put in there way back in the day, I don't know, but it's really caused us a lot of grief. If we were to simply add two deputies to the road patrol without being creative, these positions would just cause deputies to get more time off at the end of the day. So what we're proposing is to put them in special assignments. There is room in our contract for special assignments, specifically in the areas of school resource officers and traffic officers, two areas that we could really use. So we're going to ask that these two positions go into a 4-10 schedule, 4 days of 10-hour shifts, working our busiest days in hours. So they would be working Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, from 11 in the morning till 9 at night. Historically, in law enforcement, weekends and evenings are our busiest time for calls and things of that nature. So our hope is if we get these positions from 11 o'clock until, say, 2:30 in the afternoon, they're going to be serving as, like, community relation officers. They're going to be into our schools, rotating through our schools. As I mentioned in public safety a while back, since we started the initiative in our schools, our normal daytime deputies that are assigned to routine calls stopped into our schools 100 times in just a few months and visited with children and talked to staff and things of that. It's been a very successful program. The schools have really enjoyed it. So they're going to take up some of that slack and provide that service to all our schools in Tompkins County. Then they will return to the sheriff's office and hit the 3 o'clock briefing. And then for the remainder of the night, they're going to be handling traffic enforcement, trying to cut down on some of these traffic complaints we're getting nonstop, and hopefully handle some of those things as well. So.
All right. Questions? Ready for questions?
Yeah.
All right. Let's start with Martha, then Shauna.
So these two deputies aren't going into the general rotation.
They can, like I was trying to explain, and maybe I wasn't clear. If we put them into the, just add them to a typical shift, right now we have the 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. shift, 3 to 11, and then the overnight 11 to 7. If we add them to those shifts, they're just going to be counted, and people are still going to be able to get time off down to three deputies.
I don't know what that means.
You said our contract that says that when somebody on the road patrol asks for a day off, if there's three people on the shift, they will get the day off. So what that does is kind of force a minimum upon us. So if we add two deputies, say, to the 3 to 11 shift, when we're busiest, that's going to give two more deputies a chance to get the night off. It's not going to help us. It's going to be counterproductive. Does that make sense how I'm explaining that?
Aren't they supposed to get a certain time? I mean,
so you have a set amount of folks on a shift, and say every day there might be a certain amount out because it's their pass day. There's a minimum staffing provision, which means you have to the discretion to be able to approve or disapprove time off is limited to the extent that you have to have at least three people working.
Okay.
In other words, if there are five people that are working and two of them want time off, he has to approve at least two. If three want time off, he can approve two and reject one.
Right, but they have to work a certain number of hours a week, right?
They do, and they have their regular scheduled days off, which is two, but they also have quite a large amount of benefit time on top of that that they can put in for time off. And now they have comp time, too, so they can use that as well.
Where if you constrain that time off during their career, they end up with terminal pay at the end of their career. We've paid them money at the end instead of
comp time's paid out at the end of every each calendar year, so this does not accrue. It doesn't accrue from year to year. So it's nothing to do with that. It just has to do with, so you've got personal leave, you've got vacation leave, you've got comp time, you've got holiday leave?
Holiday
leave.
Yep. Personal days.
Now they're working 40 personal leave. You're working,
okay.
So you know, you've got extensive amount of available leave time. Some have restrictions on when it can be granted and some don't.
Okay.
And if you know, you're down a man or two or a person or two due to disability, now it puts a greater constraint, on the shift.
Okay.
And to couple with that, Martha, the reason it works so well with two is because if we do it this way, they're going to have time off also, the people on this shift. So that ensures if we say we're only going to approve time off for one of you on that shift, then we're always going to have one person extra on that shift when we need them the most.
Okay. So, however, it sounds like you said 11 to 3, they're going to be spending time in the schools.
Doing that and doing different community activity things. Right now, if we have anything in the community that we're asked to attend, this past weekend we had the Freeville Harvest Festival, we had the Lansing Parade and Carnival. These are all things that we have requests to staff all the time. They will be able to do functions like that as well without taking people on the road off the road or paying somebody overtime to do these sort of things.
I guess those are nice, but I don't see them as, like, really crucial.
Well, I can tell you, let's use, for example, the Freeville Harvest Festival. That gave us an opportunity to bring the DWI simulator. We spent a lot of time with the community doing that. Yes, they're nice, but they also are very important. The Harvest or the Lansing Carnival, we're doing traffic control that communities can't fund these things by themselves. They don't have people to do these sort of things. These are things the sheriff's office has been doing for years and years, and quite frankly, I think should. I think it's good community interaction.
And I think part of our job is to protect and serve. So this gives us a more opportunity to serve, in my opinion. So I would consider it very important.
So if we're in the schools lots of days of the week, are we asking them for any money?
No, I'm not. Yeah. I mean, they're not going in and holding DARE classes or things like that. What they've been doing thus far, until summer vacation hit, they're going in, maybe they're in there 5-10 minutes. They're in there, they're walking the halls, they're showing a presence from a security standpoint, they're hardening those targets where we have nationwide a lot of problems in our schools right now, interacting with students when they can and staff, see what's going on, what kind of issues are up. As I've said before, we also have them parking in parking lots when they're writing reports instead of sitting somewhere else where they're not seen, all those type of things.
Okay, one other question. Your board out budget line of $300,000, you're taking down to $100,000?
No, the $300,000 one time is not continued. So in prior years, you had the regular board out budget. That is decreasing a little bit, but that $300,000 one time, this is your third year this year. We are not continuing it into 2020. So that started 3 years ago. You haven't had the need to tap into it in 3 years. And looking at the current situation where you've been boarding in at times, we felt we didn't need to continue it. And to a certain extent, we're proposing decreasing the board out budget, the normal board target budget, just because it doesn't seem to be needed. It has not been needed as of the past 2 years and to its fullest extent. And we talked about there's probably going to be a positive impact with changes to bail and so on and so forth. And
so, okay, so first I want to say awesome, that's amazing, it's like historic, and wow. Then the next question is, but that doesn't affect the road budget, right? Those are two separate budgets, am I right?
Technically, yes. I mean, it's all under the sheriff's budget, but they're two different components.
Okay.
One's mandated, one is not mandated.
So those savings are not used for these deputies?
They are. We are proposing that because we're looking at the whole budget, the sheriff's budget.
Okay.
The jail is a mandated service. Patrol is not. But in this case, we're looking at the whole budget saying we can decrease some component of the mandated budget to allow for the first deputy to be funded.
All right. Thank you.
Let's go to Shauna.
Whenever you mentioned the role of the two deputies, you had mentioned school resource officers. And as I look around the room at my colleagues, I think probably about six of us were not very happy about that. So I wouldn't want to support a position that would be in the schools as a school resource officer.
Well, let me
explain
that a little bit. In our contract with the union, it says that it gives us certain examples that we are allowed to pull people off the road and use in special assignments. They label one as a school resource officer. That's not the title I would use, nor would that be what that person or persons would be doing. It would be specifically for community-type engagement events, which would include being in our schools, but not serving the school as a school resource officer. Absolutely not.
That's great. I also, whenever you said that, that makes more sense, because I know specifically ICSD doesn't want to go that route.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would trust that you guys would have that communication with them to make sure that you're welcome and that, you know, perhaps there is some programming. You know, I know that AIR program was around when I was a kid. It was very helpful to some people. And I think, you know, having that community relations, I think it's very helpful for people, especially in this day and age when police officers are, you know, some people have negative reaction. So.
Yeah, and like I said, I'll say it again, it's just not the school events. It's things that we're called upon constantly, all the parades, the festivals, and all that thing that is a very good community thing for law enforcement to be involved in. We've saved a lot of money. I'm doing all the parades myself, which is a good thing. You know, I should be doing those. Historically, though, deputies have been paid overtime to do these things, and that's silly. Mm-hmm. So they can help pick up some of those things that will help us.
Anna, then Henry.
When you were talking about it, you mentioned doing some patrolling. I don't know what exactly the word you used while they're at the schools. And so I was curious, is that I know it's a gray area. It's like it's fuzzy a little bit. And so is that practice or is that service something that would be in certain schools because they've asked for it and other ones because they haven't? So, for example, I know BOCES last year was given, you know, how many calls come from BOCES. They were specifically asking for it. ICSD has said they don't want it. So are you sort of walking that fine line of offering that in some cases to maybe increase efficiencies for the schools that have asked for it but not for the schools that don't? How is that?
Well, I can say, you know, in the program we've been doing since, March, I think we started through July or June when school let out, none of them asked for it. This was something we just did to expose ourselves to children, to build that relationship that we feel has really been lacking for a number of years. So we haven't had a specific school come to us and say, we want your deputies in our school. We did meet with the superintendents before we did this and talk to them about that and say, you know, how do you feel about this? They all loved the idea. Not one of them said, I don't think you should be in here. And that includes the Ithaca schools. The superintendent was there too, if I remember, Mr. Brown.
To emphasize.
But it's been very well received.
Non-environmental.
Yeah. And I have noticed schools have reached out to us a little bit more with issues since we've been doing this. So it definitely has improved the communication between us.
So two other quick questions. One is BOCES one of the schools?
Yes, we have been in BOCES.
And then the second question is there any sort of recruiting going to help people understand what the career is? Because I know you and I have talked about, I know you've talked about it, Roshana, about a desire to increase the diversity of the patrol. And so going into some of the schools, like even in middle school or going into BJM or going into ICSD system might be a way. So I'm curious if that's on your mind as well.
Yeah, I would love to see us involved in that stuff. As everybody knows in this room, improving diversity in law enforcement has been a constant battle. It's very, very difficult. For some reasons, I don't know why. We have been trying to do all we can to improve our diversity in the sheriff's office. I think we've had two full-time deputy positions come up since we've been there, and we really shook things up by hiring two females. One is Latino, and our corrections division
we had a few positions. We were able to hire a Native American, which was really cool, from Alaska. So we're getting there. It's going very slowly, not as fast as I'd like. We did advertise extensively for our upcoming test to try to improve the number of people taking our tests and a wider demographic. So we'll see what happens. So we are going to have some positions come up, especially if you give us these two.
Henry.
So I have a question is, who's doing this now? I mean, who's doing the obligation, you know, yes.
Well, as far as the school visits and things like that, it's just deputies that are on the day shift from 7 a.m. to 3 when they have time between calls, which it could be a lot more effective for that. As far as traffic enforcement, I would say it's not getting done hardly at all. That's the problem. As of last week, when I counted the number, I think we had upwards of 12 specific traffic areas of concern called in from different residences that have been complaining about the same roads for years. And we just never can seem to get people there to patrol them because they're too busy answering calls. The problem with car accidents, for example, too, that result from traffic infractions oftentimes take up a lot of resources. If a big one happens, we could have 2-3 deputies on that. These two deputies during the evening hours could be handling all that, which would free up our other deputies on shift to handle the more routine calls.
Also, I mean, they would not be doing the 11 to 2:30 stuff every day they work. At the school.
With all the schools we have in the county, the two hitting each one hitting a different school, yeah, it would be rather effective, actually. And you have to keep in mind that they would also be handling other events that may come up as well. So they may not be in the school every day, but they should be able to hit quite a few of them.
Okay, well, you said before they might hit the school for like 5 minutes.
That's what we're doing currently, yeah.
Okay. Right. But they'd say they hit the school for an hour, then they would. Then what would they do after the extra hour, the hours after that?
I would like them to be at our 3 o'clock briefing to make that contact with their supervisors and then go back out on the road and hammer the traffic enforcement.
But they wouldn't do traffic enforcement like from 12:30 to 3?
They could fit that in, too. I mean, the goal is that we would work out a schedule for them amongst administration, so when they come in every day, they're going to know this is what I'm doing that day, where I got to be, whether be a certain zone for a certain traffic issue, or maybe they're going to do a commercial vehicle enforcement detail that day. That's going to be up to us. We're going to schedule that and have that laid out for them.
And I think it all depends on what the schools have going on that day or that week. If one of them has a career day that might take an hour, they'll be there for an hour, and you know, another school might have another event that's shortly after, they might go to that. So it all kind of depends on the school schedule as well and what they need from us.
Yeah.
But there's really no way to add people to the road patrol at night because of the three,
yes,
because of that three limitation.
Right. Yeah. You know, we've also talked about there may be certain nights, you know, maybe less on the weekend nights, but the weeknights, maybe instead of not doing traffic, they'll do a warrant detail. You know, we don't know what's going to happen with our warrants with cashless bail. I'm expecting that maybe our warrants may increase. So maybe they could do that one night, too. The possibilities are really endless with us, especially with the hours we would have them on.
Wrap us up, Amanda.
Okay, great. thank you. So I just very briefly glanced at this document that you passed out to us, and it looks like you've listed quite a number of other positions that you are saying that you would like to have, but you didn't put these in as even OTRs that Jason didn't recommend.
No, we... Yeah, like I think I tried to explain, there's always what you would love to have, and then there's what is reasonable to ask for. And working with Jason, I'm very comfortable in what he recommended in this budget. I mean, it's an excellent start at a minimum and would really help us hugely.
Okay.
So.
All right, thanks.
And quick?
I'll try and be quick. Trumansburg Parade is usually the fourth Saturday in August, so write that down.
Okay.
And then on the, so section 4, page 177, where it's this second position, You have that? So when you, so for that position, it says 65,000, and then on the page before it says 55,000. So I'm just wondering about the difference in the salary for those two, and then the fringe is the fringe of the 31,000 fringe for both positions or one?
So we can explain that.
Yeah. Okay.
You can't look at them individually because they're pulling from two different budgets. They're pulling from the jail. So they all, they're both the same. They're both add up to be the same in terms of salary and fringes. They're just split up differently because the first position decreases certain other expenditure lines to make way for this position. The second one is a full position request.
All right. I trust you on that. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Derek, Jen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the enlightening us on your budget here tonight. Well, folks, you're exactly 1 hour behind.
Thank you.
Can I suggest if you have questions, please get in the queue. Don't wait till everybody else talks and then think about a question and then put it in the queue. So let's try to get in the queue. We have Board of Elections next. Our two election commissioners are here, Elizabeth and Steve.
Okay, good evening. I'm going to start out with...
So the first page is just what our expenditures are increasing for the following year. Always in even years, we increase by a lot because we have a lot more participation, a lot more paperwork. Just everything increases, and next year's a presidential election. And later in the slides, we're going to explain exactly how that's going to happen.
Okay, the major influences on our budget for next year, obviously the November presidential election is your highest turnout election in the four-year cycle. It also has associated with it very high voter registration and very high absentee ballot activity. We have two countywide primary elections next year, presidential primary in April, and then the federal / state / local primary in June. And then there's also a new law going into effect next year. It's the Uniform Primary Hours Act, which across the state, the voting hours in a primary election on primary day will be 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. Big influence in our budget this year and oncoming years will be early voting. It's the law says that we'll have early voting for 9 days prior to all elections, the general, primary, and special. This does not include village elections. And, you know, we have brand new equipment to deal with all of these changes. The early voting has driven a lot of it, and we'll eventually have to replace our existing voting machines that the voters use on Election Day.
So we need a lot of help next year, and what we're doing is taking our best election inspectors and making them clerks. So what it does is essentially we get to use them because they're very part-time at the very busy times, and it saves a lot of money instead of increasing our staff by a lot. One person can spend 4 hours just opening the mail and stamping it in and distributing it during all the presidential months, like from probably September until November. Major other expenses are we usually increase our election workers on election day by 10 to 15% because of the high participation. And then we're hoping that early voting will be popular, and we're going to have some extra staff there as well. And hopefully that will decrease the lines on election day.
Elizabeth, the microphone works best if you don't put your hand on it and you're back about 4 to 6 inches.
Okay.
Not 4 to 6 feet.
Primary elections, presidential primary does have the same associated expenses as a general election, but because we can consolidate election districts within polling places, we can use less help, that's why they're a little less expensive than the general election. And 2020 should be very similar to 2016. We had the highest voter turnout in New York State with 57% overall among the Democratic and Republican parties. It probably will be that next year. And there's, as I stated earlier, there's new legislation to increase the voting hours in primary elections. The election inspectors, extending their hours for the day by only 6 hours, but still, that's still a long day when you figure that it used to be, 9, 10 hours. So it's a long day. Early voting, it's mandated to be open for 9 days prior to every election, primary, general, or special. It's for 60 hours over those days. For this year and hopefully for oncoming years, we will have two early voting sites. This year it's going to be the Ithaca Town Hall and the Crash Fire Rescue Building at the airport. We anticipate this will make early voting convenient to as many voters as possible. And as with any polling place on Election Day, our early voting sites are equally staffed by Democratic and Republican poll workers. And the electronic poll books are really necessary to make this all happen. We need to have the ability to determine that somebody doesn't vote at one early voting site and run down to the other and vote at the other early voting site. And then once early voting is over and you have Election Day voting, we got to have the ability to make sure that we know that individuals have voted in early voting. So electronic poll books will give us that ability.
So as you can see, our employees are going up for this year, and then a lot of that will drop back down. But we're still going to need, in the local years, more personnel for the early voting. And then this is just the examples of what we need as far as the 2020 elections. You have the extra presidential election, so that's a lot of the money right there. The early voting and extended hours is the $30,000. And then our voter registration service contract is going up by 15%. The reason being is we had so much legislation passed within 6 months that they have to adapt all our programming in order to meet all the compliances with the new laws.
Questions or?
Martha?
On that slide, go back to that slide.
Go back?
Yeah, that last one. So you requested $160,000 in one time, and Jason, you've approved it in Target? What is that for?
Kevin?
I believe that may be an error on the slide. The request that's intended to cover the 2020 elections for $160,000 was a one-time request. It was approved in the recommended. It's recommended at one time.
I'm looking at packet page 17, the top of page 17. Okay, so that slide is wrong. So are we getting all new voting machines?
Is that, did I hear you say that? That you talked about your 10-year-old fleet?
Well, for this year, we're just going to have 6 new machines for early voting. We're going to be using our existing fleet of machines for Election Day voting. The goal is that sometime soon we would replace the existing machines we've had for 10 years or plus.
For 2020, you're just going to replace 6? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we've replaced the 6 already, just for early voting.
For 2019,
yeah, there's nothing in the budget right now for purchasing machines in 2020.
Got it. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Shauna?
I was wondering, with the increase in hours, is it going to be harder to recruit people to work those long days?
It's always hard to recruit the people to work those long days. Yes, I believe it will be. And it's really yet to be determined the impact that electronic poll books will have on poll workers. It's brand new. It's going to be brand new to the voters when they come to the voting booth. They're not going to have paper poll books to sign in with anymore. It's going to be pretty much totally electric, and we'll see how poll workers take to that.
I have many inspectors that have been doing it. I have one that's been doing it for 40 years, and she'll only work primary hours because they were a lesser day, but that's not going to happen anymore. We'll have to split the day with her.
Yeah, we have the ability to split a day, and we do it in certain cases, but we got to also, I think the reason we shy away from going, all in on it, split shifts, is that you got to have confidence that the second half of the shift is going to show up, mm-hmm. And I think if we are confident, then we do it.
Henry.
Well, I know the state authorized money for early voting. Do we know how much that was or where that came in?
So the part of the $30,000 for the early voting is for the actual manning of the early voting.
And so that's the money from the state?
No.
Oh.
No.
We didn't account for the revenue that the state has for it for two reasons. One, it came in last minute, but two, I would suggest we get another year or two under our belt before we account for it. Just sometimes the state makes promises and then sometimes pulls it back on occasion. So we thought, it wasn't a few hundred thousand, it was 30 or 50 grand, I think. So I think I would suggest let it develop for a year or two, and once it consistently comes in, we'll continue to try to apply for it and get the reimbursement, but I wouldn't put it in your budget until we actually have some credit, so a year or two behind it, and then we can account for it.
Okay. Also, did you, I know that security is always an issue. Did you guys do anything else in addition to having more security or checking security?
Certainly the electronic poll books that we're using have all been approved by the New York State Board of Elections, and they vetted all of the vendors and had a criteria of many things that, many steps that the poll books would have to satisfy with regards to not only functionality but for security. And they only approved, in the end, only 3 vendors, but initially 4, but one dropped out when they weren't getting much interest. But the security, I'm confident, is there. We will have procedures in place to make it even, more secure.
Anna.
Do we have a list of people who are inspectors and senior inspectors who have already, they've done it in the past, you say, for 40 years, and they do it every 4 years? We can rely on them. They've already said that they want to do it, so we just rehire them And if we do, do we have enough of them to fill these particular roles? And for those that are just manning the polling stations that we pay for, is there a baseline experience requirement, or do we do all in-house training of those positions? So there were a few questions in there, but
yeah. So we're required to train them once a year. So they are always trained once a year. And we do have a list, and then we recruit every year. And we recruit at the polling sites as well as other places of recruitment. We used to get the sub list from actually the schools to try to recruit people, but we haven't been able to get those as much.
And so then we have a running list of people who've said they're in, they're, you know, just waiting for the election years to, you know, come up. And as far as skills required, is what is the baseline skill for just doing the polling out of curiosity? Is that...
I mean, for working on election day and mm-hmm. poll book? I think the, you know, good attention to detail... The technical knowledge, certainly, that I believe that the inspectors will need to operate the electronic poll books is not overwhelming by any
okay.
stretch of
and
the imagination.
And that's all in the annual training.
And that's covered.
They're tested, too, yearly. And,
yeah.
And that annual training is in our target budget for you guys every
yes.
year.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Thank Governor you. Cuomo has been flirting with changing the presidential primary date. How would that change our planning?
Well, it'll, depending on where he wants to move it to.
moving it to February.
You know, he threw out a date of February, you know, sometime. He didn't even have a date. He just said do it in February, but that means petitioning for the delegates would start in October, right while we're doing early voting and trying to run an election. I don't think that went over very well, but, you know, then he's talked about... the last thing I heard was he was planning on having the state and local primary on the same day as the presidential primary on April 28th.
Yeah. We don't even have our early voting equipment yet, and we're going to be trained like close to the last week of September, and then pull all 300 inspectors in the following weeks to train them. So we're trying to keep up.
Yeah. Martha.
You don't run the school district elections, right?
That is correct. We work with them. We generally prepare the voting machines for them. We prepare the voting machines, we prepare the ballot, but they run the voting machines and they come up with the procedures for the voters. It's quite different than the elections we run.
We work really closely with them, though, from January until May.
Do they have a whole different set of inspectors, or is this the same
group? They generally rely on our pool. They always ask us for names, and we give them to them. But, you know, it varies from district to district. Some districts are right on top of it, and some districts, you know, struggle. But it's, you know, there's some districts where they have a different person doing it every year, and so the learning curve for that person is, you know, they're just starting real almost at ground zero every year to grasp it. And then there's other districts that have the same person been running it for years. So.
All right, so I just thought that was maybe a talent pool that you might rob. So I just, yeah.
No, they more or less
probably thought
ours.
About that.
So I have more problems finding Republican election inspectors. So I do use Democrats and non-affiliated. They just have to represent the check and balance system. But what happens is I always have enough election inspectors. But through the election, before we get to election day, I usually lose between 20% and 30% of them, either due to illnesses or just a lot of different events that come up in their lives. So we're not always first on their list.
Thank you both, and appreciate your patience with us tonight.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of patience, we appreciate the Office of Aging waiting for us tonight.
They got older.
Lisa Monroe.
Was there a, Mike, can I ask, is there an extra copy floating around of the sheriff's document anywhere?
Because
the one I had, I gave it to you. That's an extra?
When you're ready, Lisa.
Okay.
Still awake?
I think so. I think I'm still awake, yeah. So I'm going to start out with the recommended budget. There's not a lot of changes. I mean, you can see that our expenditures have just risen slightly, less than 2%. The revenues also under 2%, which is leaving a net local of about $15,000, a little over $15,000. And if you don't know our mission, the mission of our office is to assist older adults and persons with long-term care needs to live independently in their homes and in communities with quality of life and dignity. Our department, we have 15 staff members, 11 full-time, 4 part-time. One of those part-time positions is a seasonal part-time position for our HEAP program. We have 18 programs that we administer, and we have 28 contracts with 12 different subcontractors. We have 21 funding streams and 4 different fiscal years. It's fun. So our full-time equivalence has really only risen a little slightly over the years, but there's no change from last year. We're still at 12.82. Our budget seems a little boring compared to other people's right now.
I don't know, boring feels good right now.
I think that's a good thing. Good way to end the night, I hope. Yeah, good. This just is a chart of our major program areas. You can see that starting with the yellow piece of the pie is our New York Connects program. That's 11% of our budget. I'm not sure what happened to my PowerPoint here, Kevin, but something got messed up in the translation, it looks like. See that? It's chronic, yeah. Okay, but I can work through it. So nutrition services is actually 31% of our budget, which it says value up there, but it's 31%. Our nutrition services there's $459,156, which is federal, and $346,692, which is local for our nutrition services. Again, it's 31%. Our ISEP, the expanded in-home services for the elderly program, is 17% of our budget. And all other programs, planning and administration, is 41% of our budget. The next slide just really represents what percentage is paid by state, federal, or local dollars. The New York Connects program is all state funded. That's just our information referral options counseling programs that we do. The FoodNet, Meals on Wheels, is our subcontractor for that. They provide our home delivered meals, congregate dining, nutrition education, and counseling. So that's 57% federal and 43% local. Federal, state, I should say. The ISEP program is our case management program, helping to do in-home assessments for people in their homes to have personal care or housekeeping services or respite services. That's 49% state and 51% local. And all other services you can see are listed down the side. PERS program, our caregiver services, HEAP, health insurance counseling, long-term care ombudsman, friendly visiting, health promotion services, legal services, home repair, transportation outreach, north side, south side program, and our registry program. And that's 58% federal, state, and 42% local.
So this is a chart we always like to use in our PowerPoints just because it really truly does represent the dramatic shift of our population, growing population 60 plus. So baby boomers really started turning 60 in 2006. The current wave, 60 plus, is still relatively young and on the healthy side, but the oldest of the baby boomers will be turning 74 in 2020. So they are aging out, and in order for them to stay home independently in their homes safely, the services that we provide through the office, nutrition services, home care, small home repair, home weatherization, our PERS program, they'll really go a long way to be a cost-effective solution to keep people out of institutions. Our friendly visiting program and our volunteers that we have also are a huge help in to prevent social isolation. And altogether, the network of services really help keep people safe in their homes without the cost of institutions. So really, because our budget hasn't really changed that much this year, one big piece that we did get is some unmet needs funding from NYSOFA. It was the governor and Greg Olson from NYSOFA advocated quite a bit to get this into the budget. And it's a little over $85,000, but it was for unmet needs for people that were on a waiting list. And they took a point in time waiting list that we kept from our data and figured out what each county would get from that, how much funding, how much it would cost to serve those people in those particular programs. So that this is supposed to be ongoing funding. They will reevaluate it to see if people aren't going to use the funding and possibly reallocate that sometimes. But what we're going to do with it is we have to directly address the people that were on the waiting list, or at least the people, the number of people with certain programs. So we've now instituted a telephone reassurance program for people that are on a waiting list. Typically, our waiting lists are related to the lack of home health care aides. It's just there's nobody to be found to be able to serve these people. So we do have case managers, but it will be able to give people an extra safety check-in a couple times a week just to see how they're doing, see if their conditions have changed. We're also going to be sending people out from our office, outreach workers, to do a falls home safety assessment to identify, you know, further needs for falls and things like that in their home, and also possibly connect them with some other services in the community. We created a part-time case aide at DSS to assist the case managers, because part of a big portion of this funding will go toward ancillary services, which ancillary services can be anything from home repair to a PERS program. So anything that a person may need to keep them in the home safely. And with this increased funding, there's going to be more need for connections to be made, and the case managers' caseloads are so that they can't really make all those connections, so this case aide will be able to help them do that. And along the same vein, through this funding, we were able to create a part-time position for FoodNet is also for a case manager. They're really at capacity with their home-delivered meals. The registered dietitian, who technically it's out of her scope to case manage people, has a caseload somewhere around 450 people. So for her to continue to do that and for them to safely make the meals and get them to people, they are really in need of a part-time case manager. So that's where that funding is going to be going towards. And I think that's it. Do you have any questions?
Questions for Lisa. Anna?
I wrote them down, so I don't have to remember them. Packet page 43, there's program expenses.
33.
And I might have missed where this was, but there's a decrease from 80,000 to about 15,000 this year, and I was wondering what that was related to.
In program expense? And uh,
Bob's over here trying to help me with that. Come on over, Bob. Because I can't think off the top of my head like that.
Thanks, Bob.
We had a grant, an aging by design grant that ends at the end of
March.
March, yeah.
March 31st, 2020.
That's
right. So I saw reduced, that zeroed out.
Yeah, that reduced the program expense in that line.
And then on packet page 45, there's that decrease. There's like 10,000 decrease in salary and fringe. I was curious. Is that
the ombudsman program?
That's through the ombudsman, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we, that position, it had been changed to an aging service specialist position. Since the program was regionalized, it started off as a long-term care ombudsman outreach specialist, and then it was changed to an aging service specialist, so it raised it up. But after we've spent a couple years in the program, we realized we don't need somebody at that level. The person had quit, so we moved that back down to an outreach specialist position.
The opposite in, I noticed in the Title 3B, the increased.
Is that related to the deputy position? Yeah, that's related to the deputy position that we created also, which came from, which was previously my New York Connects position, but we, just to be in line with the other positions and how other county departments worked, and also there was really no one in line when Lisa Holmes wasn't there. There was no straightforward, you know, who was responsible. It was kind of like pick who's there. So we just wanted to make that streamlined. Go ahead.
And that was created by the savings and the ombudsman program.
Yes, I was wondering.
Yeah.
The last question is the cash in lieu. Can you explain what that is really, really briefly?
ICEP program. Bob Ken.
Yes. Cash in lieu, that's the nutrition services incentives program. And what that is, it's based on the prior federal fiscal year, how many meals were served by our nutrition provider, and it's set at an estimated rate. I think it's in the 70-some cents per meal. And it's money set aside in the federal budget. It's like a block grant, so it kind of shifts. Unfortunately, that funding has gradually decreased. We were getting around 120, I think, where we budgeted at 105, mm-hmm. I think, yeah.
So. Thank you.
Lisa, I was wondering about countywide, how are we doing with home health aides? I read a statistic that said that our nursing homes are not very highly rated because of the staffing levels, and I know you folks have been doing things over the years to try to raise awareness of that,
yeah,
to recognize the people who do that work.
It's still a problem. I mean, honestly, it is. You know, yes, we have through our long-term care committee subcommittee, we have a subcommittee that works directly on that and trying to increase the value placed on home health aides. We've had additional funding to increase their pay. Some of the agencies don't take, they're not interested in taking advantage of that. Particularly, it's the PCA2, we call it, which is personal care home health aides. We seem to be able to have less of a shortage in the housekeeping and assistance type aides that just kind of go in, maybe make a meal or clean somebody's house. But when somebody needs personal care and there's not an aide available, there's really not any other kind of wraparound service that you can give to that person other than institutionalization. So it's more that level of home health aid is really more of the problem, I think.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Other questions? Thank you, Lisa. Thank you, Bob Slocum. We appreciate your being here tonight. All right, gang. Round three tomorrow night, same time, same place. We're going to talk about seven different departments tomorrow night with 11 over-target requests.
Thursday.